What's up, bro?
What's up?
What's up, bro?
What is up?
We got a long episode, so we should get to it, but it's fun. We had an old friend on.
An old friend.
An old friend. A guy named Jonathan Glatcher, who is a writer. He's a producer. He's a producer and writer of one of our favorite shows. My favorite show on TV right now, Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
And we talked a lot about that. But the reality is he went to Colgate with us, and he is instrumental in the creation of Broken Lizard. And we go into that at great length.
Yeah.
So sit back because, you know.
You're going to be here a while.
You're going to be here. Well, I hope you want to hear about, you know, Colgate in the 90s and where Broken Lizard came from, because we do a little talk about that.
But we also talk about the other stuff.
We do a deep dive on that.
Yeah.
You know, your first 45 minutes is going to be in that world. And then we talk about some of the stuff, Bloodline and Better
Call
Saul.
But it's all good. It's all good.
It's all great.
Saul good.
Saul good, man.
See?
Saul good, man. Huh? Right? Yeah. All right. We got anything to plug? You plug anything? We plug any shows? Or we got anything until August?
Oh,
right?
Yeah. August. I got a show in Burlington.
You're going to be in Burlington, Vermont.
Yeah. At the Vermont Comedy Club in Burlington, Vermont. Yeah,
and that's the third weekend in August, like the 15th or 16th or 17th or something that way.
Yeah. It's the weekend before
next weekend, we're going to be in Cincinnati. We'll be at the Brouhaha Fest, which seems perfect for us. It's a combination of beer and comedy. And then we'll be the 25th and 26th, that Friday and Saturday night, we'll be down in Lexington, comedy on Broadway. Yeah. Or is it comedy off Broadway?
Comedy off Broadway.
Right, sorry about that.
So I'm 17th, 18th, and 19th in Vermont, in Burlington.
Yeah, yeah. And we're Cincinnati, and then Lexington, Kentucky.
24, 25, 26. 25, 26. After that. Yeah.
But guess what? I got an ad.
Get it.
I want to plug something here.
Plug
That's
it.
That's not our own.
Okay.
And so let's just do that, right?
Do it.
Hey, everybody. Podcast. You got to listen to this podcast. Hold On with Eugene Merman. It's the Audible comedy series, Hold On with Eugene Merman, and it's now available in podcast form. Join storytelling aficionado and inquisitive host, Eugene Merman.
No relation to Ethel.
No, but he plays Gene on Bob's Burgers.
Mm.
He's Gene on Bob's Burgers.
Uh-huh.
And he sits down with popular comedians like Weird Al, Maria Bamford, Kumail, who's very hot right now.
He's really hot.
His movie's very hot right now. Andy Richter and more. And he pauses their entertaining personal stories to get the funny details they might have left out. Sounds a lot like our podcast today,
really
doesn't
it? Really does. Really does. Just interrupting and stopping shit and digging deeper.
Going deep. Going on deep dives.
We should call our podcast Going Deep with Kevin and
going
Steve.
Going super deep.
Okay, keep going.
To the hilt, we should call it.
Balls deep. Keep going.
Okay, check out new episodes of Audible's Hold On with Eugene Merman podcast every Monday. Listen on Audible, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Hold On with Eugene Merman. Check it out.
I'm going to listen to it right now.
Okay.
And I'm going to tell them Kevin and Steve.
Do it after they listen to this.
Okay.
After they listen to our good friend Jonathan Glatzer. We haven't seen him. I haven't seen him in probably 20 years.
And the truth is, I haven't seen him in like 10 years.
Yeah. And he's a super successful producer, writer, and a great guy.
I mean, Better Call Saul, people.
Come on. Fucking love that show.
Yeah.
So anyway, we had a great time with him. I hope you enjoy it. Enjoy the chew, everybody.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Chew it
with a guy named Kevin.
Chew it
and this other guy Steve.
Chew it
from the TV and the movies and now this podcast stream.
Chew it,
they're gonna get chewy.
Chew it,
they might even get me.
Chew it,
but they're gonna get funky on this podcast thing.
Well, we should do it. Let's introduce our guest first.
Why? Why break with tradition? Why not talk for a half an
because
hour?
Because I think we're going to go back in time. I think we're going to go out of order.
Okay. Oh, we are?
Here.
Okay.
Okay.
Right, hold on.
I'm sorry.
Let's introduce our guest.
I'm sorry.
It's very exciting.
I'm sorry.
Now, this is actually going to be a really exciting special episode for us.
Great.
Because I'll say your name first.
Our
guest,
Chew Crew.
Our guest is Jonathan Glatzer. Okay. So people right now.
I have a little thing here for him.
All right, do it. Read it, Kev.
Jonathan Glatzer. He's a producer. He's a writer. He's a director.
Yeah.
But he is also an integral piece in the beginning of our careers, Broken Lizard.
Yeah.
But super successful writer, producer, Better Call Saul.
Currently a producer,
right?
and a writer on Better Call Saul.
Another show I watched and loved, Bloodline.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And which I want to talk about also.
Yeah.
And now you have a show right now, right, that you're working on in England.
Yeah, HBO show.
Bliss is called?
That's a different one.
There's a new one.
Oh.
That's another one.
What's the new one?
The new one's called Succession.
Oh, okay.
And very exciting HBO show.
The Bliss. Dude's so successful.
You know,
busy,
I love this. I love it when there's something that's not on Kevin's list. I knew about this because you and I had spoken.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not in the public knowledge
yet. Well, because the interesting thing was
it's going to break soon. It's breaking right here.
Well, because here's what happened, though, because John said, I'm not coming back for Better Call Saul seasons 4 and 5. I'm leaving the show. And so I said, I think I put my foot in my mouth. I was like, oh, that's awesome. He said, yeah, I got a new show, HBO, it's a better deal. And I was like, I take it you're the creator of this show. He's like, no, I'm not. And then, he's like, why would I leave a very successful show? And, that's kicking ass. Maybe I've totally messed up. Yeah. And so then I went.
Maybe he fucking hates Albuquerque.
Well, I think aside from the fiscal advantages of shooting in Albuquerque, for Breaking Bad, certainly, the bleakness.
Oh, yeah. That's part of the character of the thing.
But, that was originally going to be California, like Palm Springs.
Oh, really?
And Palmdale, I think, was the notion.
And then they got the incentive.
And then they got the incentive, and it had to be rewritten.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Happened to me on another film, too. It ended up in South Africa. I had to literally – this is embarrassing. I had to go on Wikipedia and figure out how people in South Africa talked.
For the writing process?
For the writing of it, yeah.
In terms of like the colloquialisms and things like that?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And people,
that's interesting.
People talked about how authentic it was.
Oh, good for you.
You did it, Jonathan. You did it.
Let's add linguist to the list of linguist accomplishments.
I think bullshitter is probably more accurate.
Let's add bullshitter to that.
I think Wikipedia, maybe actually even more. I'm giving it too much credit. It was really just like looking at videos of people talking in South Africa.
I put so much faith in Wikipedia. Wikipedia has saved my ass.
Yeah.
I think my entire life.
But there are no controls to it. I mean, who the fuck knows, right?
It's
who
true.
Does know?
Who knows?
Who knows?
It's true. For a while, it had me down as part of the Olympic fencing team in Sydney.
Okay.
And how do you think that got there?
I had mentioned it once as a joke.
Yeah.
And a bio. And somehow it kind of worked its way. The place where I did it was appropriate for me to be joking.
Yeah.
Okay. But somebody.
Somehow, it kind of made it.
Well, that's why I was in the on the Wikipedia page for a long time. I was apparently like the star of the Divine biopic. Remember Divine from the original?
Crossdresser.
The original John Waters.
Waters.
So I was apparently the star of that biopic for a while.
Were you not?
No, I didn't
Holy
get
shit.
It.
I thought that
I lost that part of Jim Gaffigan.
Another one.
Did Jim Gaffigan
Greg
play
Grunberg?
Divine?
No, I don't know. Heffernan
and Gaffigan have a...
I have guys that I lose roles to.
A rivalry.
And
wasn't he in Super Troopers?
Yeah.
But Heffernan didn't want him there.
I see.
We Heffernan tried to exercise his right to veto. Everybody's got a right to veto a certain actor in the Broken Lizard audition process. But we vetoed his veto. We super vetoed him.
Sure.
And we got Gaffigan.
The rare parliamentary
and Heffernan
move.
Wouldn't talk to him on set. He was over by craft service sulking.
What did Gaffigan ever do to you? He doesn't even swear.
I know. Well, it wasn't that. It was just a professional rivalry. Professional rivalry.
Okay.
It was like it was a time where we would be going out for the same parts all the time. I was going out for like commercials at the time.
Yeah.
And it was like early 90s, right? Probably early to mid 90s.
Yeah.
And every time I'd go in the room, Gaffigan would be in there.
Right.
And then you'd leave, and then 3 months later, the commercials would come on, and Gaffigan got every single part.
Right.
And you're like, oh, Gaffigan got it again. Gaffigan got it again.
Yeah, I think people don't realize like how much you put into an audition and how shitty it is when just another one doesn't come your way.
Yeah.
And it makes sense. Resentments build up.
But it was a friendly resentment.
I love the guy,
and he's been in 3 of our movies now.
Yeah.
And
he wasn't famous back then.
Yeah. Right.
He was just becoming famous at the expense of Kevin Heffernan. and he nailed his audition, and we were like, he didn't want him. He's like, I hate that fucking guy. And we're like, dude, he's awesome. We're having him.
Right.
And they're like, so it's Soder and I are in the meow scene with him.
Yeah.
And between takes, he was dirty.
Yeah.
And he was talking nasty. I'd go run over to Heffernan. I'm like, he talks dirty. And then I go running back to him. And by the end of the day, we were all laughing with great Gaffigan. And Heffernan was like sitting very far away from us.
All right.
But you tried to veto Lemmy as well.
I did.
I was just reading in Jay's book.
I did. And it backfired. And now here I am sitting with him 30 years later.
Although,
I didn't like Lemmy.
Vetoed me in the fraternity house and then vetoed me in the Kinetic Theater Company.
I did, actually.
Yeah, he
I
didn't did. Want me to be a part of Charred Goose.
All right, but let's move this to Glatzer, because we're talking a lot about us. I want to talk about Glatzer.
Right. And this is a great segue.
And this is a great segue.
I was just trying to fucking do that.
I know it. Okay.
It was elegant.
Okay.
You know what? This is what happens.
This is part of the dynamic. It's part of the dynamic.
We can go back.
But
we can edit, right?
We have the technology.
What?
We're not going to.
We're going
to
throw it today.
We want people to hear
this. We'll put it up today. Here's a shit.
Yeah.
I want to get to all the writing stuff, but I feel like people who listen to this and people who have read Jay's book and all that kind of stuff, we want to talk about the early time, and you're the guy who you are responsible. Because back in the day, you were very involved in the theater at Colgate, where we all went to college together, and you created this your own kind of theater program called the Kinetic Theater, and gave Jay the opportunity to direct something, and he did our comedy group. So
I insisted that he do it. Yeah.
Before you get into it, I just want to, like back then, so you and I were in the same class together.
Yep.
And when we arrived at Colgate, I remember just as a non-theater person, I was aware that the theater program was not that good.
No.
The plays were
moribund.
Pretty bad.
Right. To use a word that the director of the theater program would have used.
Right.
About other things, of course, but Atlee Sproul,
yeah.
But that was God your passion, that area. That was your passion, right?
It was, I guess. I had a theater company in high school.
Okay.
And a lot of that was...
Where did you go? Where were you in high school?
I was in New Jersey.
Okay.
I ended up in high school in Westfield, New Jersey. I grew up for most of my years in North Caldwell, New Jersey, which is the Sopranos' hometown.
Okay, all right.
Grew up next to David Chase, actually.
Oh, you did?
Directly next to the creator of the Sopranos.
Okay.
When I got to Colgate, I applied to NYU and to – it was basically whatever was on the common application. I didn't know that I even wanted to go to college. I didn't know what the fuck I wanted to do.
Sure.
I thought maybe I'd be a good lawyer.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I think we all.
You know, it's funny though, as you say you're from Jersey, and now I'm hearing a Jersey accent. You're like
a little bit.
I know what I wanted to do. I know what
he
I wanted
next to
do.
David Chase. Come on.
Yeah,
that's where you think it's coming from.
I recently, when I was in London, sort of being quizzed about who I was, I came up with the expression that I'm actually a pretentious thug. That I have that in me. I have the thug in me. I mean, my dad was the dentist to the Bonomo family.
Okay.
My best friend in sixth grade, his dad got whacked in the driveway.
Really? Holy shit, really?
Yeah. I mean, if you watch the Sopranos opening sequence, it's basically a sequence driving to my house.
Yeah.
It's right,
driving by the butcher shop.
The butcher shop. I know exactly where all that is. That's in Little Falls, though. That's not in North Caldwell.
Okay.
But if you're into that, if you're a guy who loved the theater, and how do you end up at Colgate though? I mean, that's way up in the middle of fucking nowhere.
Because NYU lost my application.
No,
because
really?
My dad, the fucking swinging dentist with the mafia, was dating the vice president of NYU at the time.
Really?
Broke up with her. Broke her heart.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. That always
and
comes
you
down.
You got screwed.
To that.
You got screwed.
And the application went missing.
Holy shit.
Amazing.
Yeah. And then and Colgate. Yeah. And I was going to – I tried to transfer, actually.
Yeah. Freshman year or something?
After freshman semester. But by that point, freshman semester, I had done – was that freshman semester? Ghent?
I thought you started Kinetic Theater our freshman year.
No, it was my sophomore year. But the either freshman year or first semester or second semester of freshman year – this amazing director, Bob Lawson, came and did this extraordinary production of Peer Gynt.
Yeah.
At Colgate.
Yeah. And that's where Jay and I met.
Was Stolhansky in that? No. Somebody was in that. One of our guys
Soder?
Was in that.
Soder might have been
Soder maybe. Was not know. In that. Soder was more of a...
On the razzle. Soder was on the razzle.
Soder was a stooge of the university theater. Right.
He was. He was an Atlee Sproul stooge.
He saw the light.
In his work,
after Atlee died. But
Soder was the stud of university
theater. Absolutely was.
As a freshman, I remember he got the lead in the first thing he tried.
Yeah, on the razzle.
And then the Razzle. That's
yeah,
right.
That's what it was. Yeah.
Who's this hot new freshman?
We were, because our fraternity brother was also one of the Al Irvine. Yeah. And we went to go see it, and I was like, who is this freshman stud, Paul Soder?
Yeah.
And by stud, we mean it tongue in cheek.
Yeah, funny actor, I mean.
Yeah.
He was good.
He was very good.
I mean, he's a talented actor.
Yeah, no, I never worked with him otherwise.
Oh, really?
I always wanted to.
But you put up plays immediately when you got there, or no?
So we did this production of Peer Gynt, which was, if you guys didn't see it, you missed out, honestly.
Okay.
It was fucking amazing.
Okay.
And I mean, it's hard for me to say because I was not watching it.
Right.
But it was just.
And it was a guest director.
Came in. He was 30 years old at the time. And
just a young man.
Ali Sproul. Yeah. Immediately hated him.
I bet. Sproul was, you know, yeah.
Sproul was a nasty old.
He's territorial. He's been territorial.
Yeah.
Bitter old.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
God rest his soul. God rest his soul.
Rest in peace.
Yeah. That's another story. You know, and he died while I was there, while we were all there, I guess. And
oh, he did?
And there were people who actually, his secretary was a woman named Garda.
Okay.
Who guarded him, literally.
Really?
His reputation, okay. his everything. And when he died, she went around blaming me and Bob Lawson for his death, that we drove him to get – he went back on the wagon – or no, off the
fell
wagon.
Off the wagon.
Fell off the wagon.
Okay. Something about a wagon.
Okay.
So blaming you because you started the Kinetic Theater Company, which sucked all the life out of his theater program?
And a lot of his talent. Adam Paul was also one of his great actors, and he was the lead in Peer Gynt, and
right.
he was in my productions, and
yeah.
At Stilhansky for that matter, and you know, just a lot of great – Lauren Bright.
Yeah.
A lot of people who he had sort of fostered
came over to
do Kinetic Theater.
Steve Lemmy.
Yeah.
Steve Lemmy and I never worked together.
I took an introduction to directing class with Ali Sproul, which is where I met Soder.
Okay.
Okay.
That was my junior year, if I remember correctly.
That was a funny moment.
It's a very funny moment.
Right.
Which I'll tell. It was junior fall.
But was Jonathan in that class too, or no? He was there.
No, I was. I never.
No, he was beyond that.
Okay.
Glatzer was beyond that.
Sorry.
So I was there, and I remember early on, I was still sitting in the back row because I wasn't a theater guy. But I kind of thought I wanted to like do some acting or some directing, and so I thought I would this is what was available, and so I took the class, and Soder was in the class, and he was up in the front row, just sucking at Lee Sproul's dick, and I was in the back row, and I remember making a point, like in the first week, or raising my hand to make a comment, and I remember that while I was making it, I could see Soder shaking his head no. And while I was speaking, I was looking at this guy, and like I was like, "Who the fuck is this motherfucker?" I'm from New York City. I was like, "Who the fuck is this motherfucker?"
Yeah.
But really, like, and I never liked him after that. And so, like,
little did you know, he was the stud of the drama department.
I think I had heard something like that at that point in time. But what I knew was that he had his word was spread because that was the semester the Charred Gooseby. A.K.A.
Yeah.
Broken Lizard,
yeah.
started. That
so
he
I was,
was
actually in London.
That he was supposed to, and we'll get back to that story, but that he was supposed to be a part of, he was supposed to be one of the directors, and it didn't
happen. Right.
He wasn't?
He was not, no. He blew it off. He admits it.
Yeah, you asked him to do it.
Yeah, but go back. So you were disenchanted with the drama department at Colgate. You decided to start your own theater group, essentially.
I was disenchanted with the theater department. I really did try to agitate to get... It turned from – it was only a minor to get a major going.
And were you acting in the plays?
Not the university plays, but it was – Peer Gynt was the only thing I acted in. It's actually the last thing that I ever acted in.
Really? In your life?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I enjoyed it tremendously. As I was saying, I wished I had been able to watch it more than in some ways being in it.
Yeah.
And acting – I'd been a kid actor a little bit when I was growing up. And, you know, at some point, I realized I wasn't good at it. I didn't buy it. I didn't buy myself in it. You know, and I think that my own – the more I got into it, and I did a lot of it, you really have to be very comfortable with making yourself malleable.
Yeah.
And I'm much more rigid than that as a person.
You should smoke pot, dude.
I smoked from 14 so until last night.
Okay. But, it calms you down, man. Cool. It makes you less rigid, bro.
But not on stage.
Yeah, I don't know.
Have you ever tried to smoke pot on stage?
No, but I was just thinking of that production of Peer Gynt. Artie Nelson was in it, and Artie Nelson was great in it.
Yeah.
He's this big personality, also a writer here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that, I think it was the last night, he dropped acid.
Okay.
In the show, I was in an insane asylum, in a scene in an insane asylum, and I do this monologue, and then I put a noose around my neck and hang myself.
Right, right.
And it was Artie's...
Spoiler alert.
Right. Yeah. It was Artie's job to hook the harness up.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
He was fucking tripping balls.
Jesus.
Okay.
And I think it was John Cook.
Yeah.
Oh, our old friend John Cook.
Big old John Cook, who saw what was about to happen, which was... I was about to hang myself on stage.
Standing ovation. Yeah. What a performance.
Yeah, right.
Hey, is he dead? Hold on a second.
No, it was worth it. So he saved my life.
Okay, that's great.
John Cook saved your life.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's great.
If I got any details there wrong, but I'm quite sure it was John Cook.
Well, it's funny because
he was an original member of our comedy group also.
Member of it. And now I'll just go back. Soder was not, but Soder joined eventually, and then Soder fired Jonathan Cook from Chartreuse.
Oh, dear.
Which was not a pretty sight.
Now, did you direct that Job?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, JB.
It was JB, and then Chandrasekhar was the lead.
Yes, he was.
And I remember cursing you out during that fucking thing. And I'll tell you why. Do you know why?
I heard the podcast with Jay. And
right.
Yeah, you had to turn around.
Yeah, you had to.
Like, you had to sit on
your
a
thing
bat.
It was like a kind of a theater in the round where the audience was in the middle and the performance was going on around the audience.
That's right.
And you had to sit on the ground and watch the play. And we all had to go. Not had to go. I wanted to go. Chandrasekhar was the lead, but it was expected that you went and you supported your friends and whatever. Yeah. And so we went to see Chandrasekhar, and I had to sit on the – and I'm not good at sitting on the ground.
Yeah.
So I sat on the ground for like 2 hours.
Yeah.
And I was like, Jonathan Glatzer, you were trying to elicit some sort of response out of me from being uncomfortable. It made me so mad.
That was the response I was going for.
I know, and it worked. Yeah. It totally worked. Bullshit.
It worked for Jay, too, because I think he was very uncomfortable in that role as well.
He was probably uncomfortable.
I definitely put the screws to him to form Charred Goosebeak.
Yeah.
I also put the screws to him to play Job.
Okay.
First. I mean, I guess that was just sort of the nature of our relationship for a while.
Okay.
What? Because he had done something else with you before that, or
we were in Peer Gynt together.
All right. But regardless.
Okay. So you're disenchanted with the theater program.
I was disenchanted and I was inspired by Bob Lawson and Peer Gynt. But I got Adam Paul, who really was just this phenomenal talent.
He's great.
To agree to do a production of an Edward Albee play called Zoo Story.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got all these other characters, Eric Zamor and Lauren Bright.
Oh, right,
And we did these two one-act plays by Edward Albee.
Yeah.
Zoo Story and American Dream. And, it was revelatory in its way. You know, I mean, I think the reason why we're sitting here in some measure is that we all had experiences while we were in college that you're supposed to have,
mm-hmm.
where you kind of figure out what you're good at,
what you
want to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was that for me. That was doing that production, those two productions.
Yeah.
And
we were
in the middle of fucking nowhere, too.
Oh,
we were in upstate New York. We could make mistakes. All we had to deal with was
peer pressure.
Peers.
And
which was significant at times.
Sure.
But, but basically, we could sort of evolve and do our thing. And so out of that, I guess I stopped wanting to be a lawyer.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. And was like, this is what I always have been doing. Why would I stop just because my father thinks it's not a safe business to go into?
Right.
Which he was completely correct about.
You're doing all right.
Yeah. You want to be a mob dentist.
That's right.
That's the safe.
That's right. No danger there. You had to agree to not save the dental records, by the way.
All right. Destroy the dental records.
Yeah. And then the next semester, it was such a thing because Colgate had just this turgid theater program.
Yeah. And people wanted to get involved. I mean, people wanted to do that kind of show. I mean, like, this guy's a perfect example. So,
By this guy, he's gesturing to
Steve Lemmy.
Right.
Yeah, honestly, it's
people
it's,
looking for that outlet.
But like, I think sometimes the community can be a little. I found it in my high school in New York, and I found it in my high school in Colorado, and then I found it at Colgate too, which was that, like, I didn't necessarily like the people that were in the theater program, and,
right.
and Atlee Sproul, mm-hmm. rest in peace, was sort of the
the illustration of why theater sucks.
Yeah, and then and frankly, like Soder was a guy who like represented that as well. It's like
right. oh shit. Yeah.
Well, you know,
at the time,
and like
one of your closest friends.
At the time, it was like, and we talked about that. I mean, you know, sure, Soder knows the story too.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
He's like, you must have hated me.
We laugh about it.
I was like, I did hate you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, it was not, I didn't find it like sort of emotionally accessible, and it wasn't right. something I wanted to be a part of, but like, I had the bug in me. And frankly, I remember when Kinetic Theater started and it was getting rave reviews, and it sounded to me like, I heard about the thing in the round. I was like, that sounds cool. I wish I had been able to see Heffernan's face sitting there getting pissed off.
Like, oh, my ass hurts.
Yeah.
Oh, geez, you know, my legs are sore.
I'll grant you, Kevin, that was, for one thing, it was the result of limited resources.
Sure.
Because Atlee did whatever he could to keep my budgets.
Yeah.
To,
and you were in the Hall of Presidents, wherever it was, right? You were in the theater.
We called it site specific work, and it was basically like, you're not allowed to use the theater, so figure it out on your own shithead.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. You know, we found these risers and we kind of built it in the round.
Yeah.
But it was, in a way, you know, your sophomore thing that you do, or your second thing that you do, when the first thing is a success, the second thing is always the hardest to not overdo it.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you're, I guess I was like 19 years old, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, no question, I overdid it a little bit with JB.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
I
mean, it was cool. You know, it was in the round, and on either side were two stages.
I'm being an annoying dick. That's all.
It was a cool
thing to see. I mean, it was.
By the way, cut to 2 weeks ago when he and I went to see Baby Driver together.
Yeah.
And the trailers hadn't indicated that there was like a La La Land aspect to it. Heffernan. I mean, we were both pissed off. We were like, I imagine it's the same.
It wasn't what I expected. That's all.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
Okay.
Anyway. Okay. So, Kinetic Theater.
So,
well, your sophomore thing was JB. Then you're saying
JB,
your second thing, attempt, and then the third year was the year that
So the first semester of the third year of my junior year, I went away.
All right, you were in England.
To England,
okay,
to do a semester there,
right?
And it was a tough choice. And if I could do it over again, I wouldn't have left.
Where were you? Okay. What did you do then?
I was doing an English theater program thing there. And, it was great. And I had an amazing time there. But I also had this thing going at Colgate.
That you were leaving
theater,
behind.
And I was leaving behind. Yeah. And two shows does not a theater company make.
Yeah.
But it was, I think, turned out to be all well and good as far as you guys are concerned. I wanted to do 4 one-act plays or three, and then for Jay to do a comedy group.
Right.
And
you had handpicked who you wanted to do all those.
Yeah,
all
Soder
those
was one.
Soder was one of them.
And I think Lauren Bright did one.
Lauren Bright did
called
one.
Called Soap Opera.
Yeah.
Right.
Because I came and auditioned for all these.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll get back to that.
Okay.
Okay. So you left, but you got dough and you set up these four productions while you're in your absence.
Well, I read Jay's account and it was completely accurate. Yeah, I kept calling him throughout the summer to get him to see the light.
Yeah.
And I think, wasn't he kind of on his way to becoming a doctor or something?
I think he had given that up right after freshman year, probably.
Okay.
He was on that track of pre-med, and then like he slept through his organic chemistry class and then bailed out, and then it was over, you know?
Right.
I don't think it was everything he really wanted to do, you know? He always wanted to do comedy. And I think you gave him that opportunity.
Yeah.
And granted, it was the same way with Soder or whoever. It's like you're in college at the time and you're having fun and you're coasting along. You're like, do I want this responsibility?
Right.
And I think he struggled with that for a long time.
Yeah.
About whether he wanted that responsibility.
Well, I think
you pushed him towards it.
I did. I think the thing with the comedy group was the one X. If Soder, I forgot that happened. Yeah, that Soder, it kind of fizzled out, which is fine. You know, I mean, nobody's, if there's another one X or another 2 1 X, that's a show there.
Yeah.
But the comedy group was something that I really wanted to do.
Yeah.
Partly because I think I had been doing this very highbrow stuff.
Yeah.
And I wanted – and that wasn't the whole of me anyway.
Yeah.
And wanted something to kind of come in and – because all the stuff that we did at Kinetic always had a sense of humor to it.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was
serious shit, but
– But offbeat.
It was ridiculous.
And it was,
You know, it was always absurd.
That to me was the appealing thing about it. You know, like – I mean, honestly, it was like the university theater program was like – the DC Comics movies, and Kinetic Theater seems to be like Marvel Comics movies.
Okay. Yeah, Aristotle, like, how do you feel about that?
Okay, we are in a comic book store.
Yeah. No, no. I mean, I remember, like, when Kinetic Theater started, I legitimately respected you and admired you because, like, you were the only person I knew in the entire school. I mean, look, there were people who started bands, and that was, like, sort of common. But, like, this was something – I was like, holy shit. That – Glatzer started a theater program here? And it's, like, a thing? That's awesome.
Yeah.
Literally.
Thank you. Yeah. That's great to hear. Yeah. And, you know, the truth is that I don't think I could have done that at NYU.
Yeah.
I think that part of the part of the thing – and I think this may be part of the reason why we do have – a good number of people represented in the business. We had you know, frat jocks and this was who we had to work with, and you had to kind of find that in any population, no matter where you go, there are people who have something to offer.
Yeah.
And sometimes they have a tremendous amount to offer, mm-hmm. and you just kind of have to peel back the layer a little bit, mm-hmm. and you kind of create these performances, and nobody's coming in necessarily with, at the time, these ambitions to be an actor.
Yeah.
They weren't going to Tish. They weren't. You know, they wound up in.
But it was because in that environment, it allowed that kind of thing to flourish. It was interesting because that is exactly what happened with us. I mean, we weren't highbrow what we were doing, and it wasn't. But what we did was be able to skewer things that were going on at the campus. And I'm not talking about highbrow stuff. I'm talking about making fun of the cop, making fun of that professor, making fun of whatever event that was going on at the campus, like, or the social interactions. And
the cap is taking over the deke.
Yeah. We were able to skewer that stuff.
Yeah.
And people really responded to it because they were like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Nobody's doing this.
Yeah.
And then we did it. And that was the reason. And like you said, at a someplace bigger or someplace different, that might not have been the case that was possible.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. But, you know, it's funny. When I came back from London and everything, you know, happened with Charred Goose Beak, and it was this huge hit.
Yeah.
And there was this meeting that I had with you and Soder, because Jay graduated and he basically handed the reins to
Soder,
Stephen Paul.
Yeah.
And
not to me.
Not to Steve.
I don't know if you can remember. No, it was you were there.
No. He didn't give it to me.
Paul. Okay.
I was too irresponsible.
That's Lemmy was different then. He was he's grown up since then.
Yeah.
He was different then.
But although I have to admit that ultimately I would not have handled the leadership role of of Charred Goose Beak well. Like it would have fizzled. But I was annoyed.
There were some tough personalities also.
There were some difficult personalities.
But I think also it was like and Soder was probably more in that world in a sense. Like Soder was invited to join the first inception of it, and he passed in the same way that he passed on actually directing a show.
Uh-huh.
And then
that's what studs do.
That's what they do. They pass. They wait. Yeah. And then he came to the show, and we have this wonderful video of it. Because we, you know, had a lock off. You know, you put one camera in the back of the room and you tape the show, and the camera's locked off back there, and we just left it running. And then at the end of the show, you see Paul Soder walk up while everyone's milling about, and he kind of corners Chandra Sekhar and was like, wow, you could see him like da da da, and how much he loved it.
Right.
And then he wanted to be in.
That's great.
And so he was in the next semester.
Yeah, right. Although
I
tried to get him not to be in that. I was like, you can't, I hate this dude. I fucking hate this dude. And Jay was like, he's a genius.
Yeah. And then he came in.
Okay,
yeah.
This is my confession of Soder and you to some extent too, because we had this meeting. You were there.
I remember.
It was in
this.
The co-op. And I didn't quite remember this until I was coming over here and I was trying to remember some of the stuff that it was so biblical in its proportions for us in this tiny little fucking place.
Sure.
But I came back from London and it was like, okay, so Charred Goose Beak, let's keep this going.
Yeah.
And you guys were like, yeah, we're going to keep it going, all right. But we don't need you.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. We don't need Kinetic Theater for that matter.
Yeah.
We'll take our financing and go do our thing.
Yeah.
And I was so fucking pissed at you guys.
I remember this. No, I remember this.
So this is you and Soder?
Because
the second semester, the second show we did, and we brought people in.
This was the next year.
Okay, the next year. So because the second semester we did, we brought Lauren Bright into our thing. Stalhansky came into our thing. Yeah. Soder came into our thing for that second show.
And I was there for that.
And you were there then.
I was
in the Hall of Presidents.
Yeah.
And then we, Jay and I and Lauren were out, and Allison Clapp. No, was it Allison Clapp?
Yes.
No, she was gone.
And then you guys took over.
But here's the truth. It's like it was actually – the reins were handed over to
Griffin
to Soder and Griffin.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Griffin. Yeah.
And I was annoyed about that, but like they thought it would be best for me to be in there to have the conversation.
I forgot Griffin was in there.
Where they were gonna like where this Where the divorce was going to happen.
Wow. Divorce.
Yeah.
I didn't know that story.
Yeah, but you know, here's the thing. In thinking about it, it makes total sense that you guys would see me as like, well, you were in fucking London, man, when this thing was happening.
Dude, and we're the Rolling Stones.
That's right.
And I remember that because the quote was after that first show, like the newspaper went crazy. Right? Yeah. Like the people wrote these articles and like, it was Colgate, your comedic messiah hath risen.
Yeah.
That was the quote. And you're like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you guys were all fucking full of it. Huh?
Yeah. And a year earlier, I had the same sort of press.
Right. For your stuff.
American
yeah.
Dream. And
yeah.
So we were bound to either... get married or clash,
yeah.
and especially with me coming back from London and doing my thing.
I remember our mindset. I remember it was that like the feeling was that you were going to put the clamp on us, like you were coming back to now like rein in les enfants terribles.
Right.
And but I wasn't, you know, like I wasn't into it because these guys were gone.
You right. hated those guys,
and I
Griffin
hated
and Soder.
Yeah. I think I did dislike Ted Griffin. I can't remember.
Hatred in your heart, Steve.
Yeah. I mean,
he just liked me so much. That's why. And I was gone.
I did. We were best. Listen, we did the Socrates-Plato sketch. They were best friends after
that's
that.
That's right.
That was a great
it was
sketch.
Over. Yeah. It was over then.
But they wanted me to be in there as I think a stooge of some kind. I was already kind of.
And what happened? What did you guys? Was it a fight?
It was not a fight because, you know, what are you going to do? You know, you guys want to go off on your own. Go for it.
Yeah.
You know, I have the financing for you guys to do this, but you can do that and take it and do your own thing.
Sure.
It was sort of like I think that what I was offering was like, well, I've negotiated the bureaucracy.
And neither of those guys have the acumen or had the ability at that time, I thought, to navigate what you navigate.
They hadn't dealt with like Dean Marge Loop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And nor did they would they have. You
no.
know, would they have had the
I'm sure you guys
wherewithal.
Had to deal with it after that. But you know, it was sort of just like, you know, I can help out here. And it was, again, I fucking get it. Now I get it.
Yeah.
Because it's the same thing of what we were talking about, though. You guys had that year, certainly. I mean, I don't mean to presume. I remember you did an Argentinian breakdancing commercial. But I think it's pretty safe to say.
I was a professional actor.
Yeah. I think it's pretty safe to
say. And dancer.
Yes. That you guys had the most significant creative experiences of your life. And perhaps
absolutely.
That's probably in some ways still the case because, you know, it was pure and
– Oh, yeah. I had spent 3 years getting drunk and dicking around, and then we did that thing my senior year. It was great.
Yeah. And
it defined me. You know, it had something to do with defining me.
If you don't take ownership over that, then it's just not the same.
Yeah.
And so you guys took ownership over it, and it didn't, you know, get in my way particularly either. I mean, I was doing – I kept going. Doing my stuff, but it did create this rivalry, and I think on the whole it was a healthy rivalry.
Well, but there was no show because
did you guys not do a show?
No, like we started.
Oh,
to.
Oh, that's right, Griffin. Yeah.
We started to.
Once Heffernan and Chanseger are
no,
gone,
but you came
it's
back
over.
And did more stuff, right?
No. Like I don't know if you remember this. I dropped out, by the way, at Thanksgiving. Like the whole thing had become. It became super corporate.
Jesus, I don't know that I. I mean, of course, I would have known this at the time, but my memory has it that you guys kept going.
It wasn't fun anymore. Yeah. It was. It had become something different.
Right.
And then,
because I wasn't there,
and then I left, and then I know that the show never went on.
Oh, that's right. Jesus, now
I don't.
But it still exists to this day, though. Do you know that?
Oh yeah,
Charred Goosebeak does. Yeah.
By the way, I apologize for our arrogance now, all these years later, for going in there. I had no idea that you were so upset.
I didn't know that happened.
You were so pissed. I probably did.
Yeah, I think you must have.
Did the meeting end poorly?
Yeah. No, I mean it was just like, okay, well, go
good
with
luck.
God.
Good luck.
You know, I mean, there was nothing to really say except as you would with any divorce. I mean, it was just like, okay, guys.
But it's a bummer though because
thanks for nothing.
It's a bummer because you and I were friendly like from the beginning of college, and so it's like, and I was not feeling at all allied with Ted.
It's so funny because you don't. Not only did I not know that. Or remember that, but it's crazy to me that in my memory, you guys went ahead and did fantastic things. And what I'm remembering is the year before, obviously.
When I was
and
there.
What I'm not remembering,
when I was there.
You'd think that if there was a competition there and if it all fizzled out because egos were and I'm remembering now that's kind of what happened. There was just the weight of egos of a bunch of 19-year-old fucking arrogant fucks that I would have relished in that, and that would have been part of my own remembrance of it. But it's not. I remember you guys going on that year and doing great things, but I just conflated things to suit my own thing, which was that you guys must have been. It's just funny to me anyway.
But regardless, you'd created a situation.
Wait, are we
for
friends?
Us to do
are we
this.
Friends again? I don't think.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I
actually don't think there was any residual tension after that. Although I wasn't at Colgate anymore, so maybe there was.
Yeah, you failed out, so, or whatever you did. Yeah, dropped out.
We went into different circles for sure, but it was, you know, it's, I think to that extent, this is kind of this great coming together. I mean, we lived through a lot from 17 to 21, whatever, and. You know, we saw each other occasionally over the years.
Yeah.
But we haven't seen each other since, college.
Not in years. No.
And,
So then we ran into each other. You had just started. I don't know. I shouldn't say you had just started. But we were at Ira Liss's house here in California, and you had moved out here. Yeah. That was the first I'd heard. You were out here, and you were writing.
Yeah.
And probably had been to it for a long time, but.
No, I, you know, what happened was I directed this movie. We're skipping way ahead now, but it's all, this is a pretty.
Sorry, all the Colgate people are going to stop listening now.
Okay.
Other people will start listening now. So.
It was another volcanic time in my life when I made this movie with Steve Coogan as the lead. And
what was the name of it?
It was called Safety Glass. It was released as
But that wasn't the name, right?
What Goes Up was the release.
Right. Yeah.
And Molly Shannon and...
And you wrote and directed it?
Wrote and directed it. Okay. Actually, the co-writer on that was Bob Lawson.
Oh, wow.
But the way I was looking at it, there's someone else who was involved in that movie who we knew from other circles. R.D. Robb?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Remember?
Yes.
Who did he used to go out with?
No, so R.D.
Well, he went out with somebody.
Well, Amy Israel's his wife.
Amy Israel. Oh, are they married?
They are married.
Okay,
with
I don't know.
Two kids, beautiful children.
Oh, great.
And,
okay.
Life is,
okay. Okay. Because they were together when we knew them.
Right.
Yeah.
That's how we knew him, right?
R.D. Robb and I... lived in their house, Amy and RD's house. We didn't live there, but I spent my every day there working, trying to get financing for this fucking movie for years.
Yeah, sure.
And what year was the movie?
The movie was made in 2007,
okay.
Finally.
Okay.
Long story short, we the independent film scene, which is as dead as can be now.
Absolutely. We know.
Was in its final sort of throes then.
Yeah.
This was a script that originally, two companies, Good Machine and Addis Wexler, they're called Industry Entertainment now.
Yep.
They came aboard as co-producers, and these were the two hottest companies in the world. They made all of Ang Lee's movies with Good Machine and Happiness, Todd Solondz movies, and at Industry they
were at the height of the independent. Yeah. You know,
Robert Altman's movies, Shortcuts, and they were coming together for the first time because they both wanted to make this script.
Yeah,
and it was wonderful. And then 3 months later, they had both lost their overhead deals with the studios, respectively, that they had deals with. and so basically, you could sort of chart the disintegration of the indie film movement when you look at this movie.
Yes.
Because these two companies were at their peak, and I caught them just when
they were going down
and they continued to do great stuff. And Ted Hope is the, you know, the head of
Amazon
now. He's a Good Machine. James Sheamus was head of Focus Features. They did fine, but my movie was sort of like the kid in the divorce that who had to kind of choose between the parents. You know, who are you going to go with now that we can't? There were fuck yous exchanged at Sundance
because they were at odds with each other. Is that
they were at odds with each other because now that they both lost their money, someone had to pay for things.
And yeah, sure.
It was just very messy as these things go. And anyway, that was the beginning.
Yeah,
and then actually I got RD on board, RD Robb on board.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember exactly how we met, to tell you the truth.
Were you friends with them back when the whole Plum thing was going down?
No. Okay. No, we met after Plum. That's another podcast.
That is a whole other podcast. Yeah. In case people should look up R.D. Robb and Plum.
Yeah, and Leo DiCaprio.
And Tobey Maguire. And see a famous Hollywood blackballing.
Sure.
Yeah, that's quite a story. So I think we were both kind of walking wounded at this point because I had been through a couple of times. And so I think twice we got financing for the movie. Twice we had casts for this movie, set up, ready to go, and twice the financing fell through because it was basically a house of cards that the financing was built on. There was one guy who was a mafia dude out of Philadelphia.
Sure.
Who
that's the way it always works. They tell you, and then they have the money, and then you don't have the money, and then when push comes to shove, you're screwed. And
it's just a shit show.
Anybody who's been in the bit has, you know, we've done that, and you know that particularly also that time was a horrible, horrible time for film. Anyway, that 2007, 2009, that whole area, because the money, it was recession, the money had dried up, nobody had any money to make any movies.
Yep, except for this one guy.
Which guy?
His name is. Shit, maybe I shouldn't mention
Luigi Bonino.
I came to my father's office oftentimes, and
he needed a root canal.
I think he's known for having a violent temper. So for my own sake, I'd love to fucking name the guy.
Is it Kevin Heffernan?
Yeah, it's me. It's Kevin. I have a lot of money and a violent temper.
he stole. We had a $4.5 million budget. He stole $2 million.
Okay.
And
for himself?
For himself and a couple of his partners.
Was it one of those deals where, hey, we'll make the movie and then we're allowed to pocket what's left over and just pocket? That's pretty much what happened.
That wasn't actually spelled out in the contract.
Right, but that's what happened. Yeah. We've had that several times
as
well.
And it was like, okay, we had a contract.
Yeah.
So sue me.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you going to do?
Right.
You know, what resources do you have, kid?
Sure.
Yeah.
And also, RD had been through this horrible experience with Plum, and he was gun shy about getting back into that, and I totally get it.
Of course.
And it was just, it would have been, we'd probably still be in some kind
of. And so, did you ultimately get distribution, or?
Yeah, Sony came through.
Was Sony Classics or Big Sony?
No, it was Big Sony, but it was another one of these fucking things where this other shithead in Canada.
Yeah.
While we were in the editing room, which I was editing, because in the snake pit of it all of these assholes who were thieves were now suing each other.
Sure.
and nobody was cutting the movie.
Right.
So I was like, all right, I kind of know how to work Final Cut.
I'll do it.
And suddenly I became the fucking editor.
Good for you.
In the credits, it's listed as Fensteritsky, which was one of the characters that we kind of had to we didn't cut him. Essentially, when we lost the $2 million, we had to make a different movie.
Okay.
And I remember being in Steve Coogan's hotel room, going up to him, being like, "If you want to drop out of this, I totally get it."
Okay.
You know, we went from 34 days of shooting to 26 days of shooting, and you guys know that's like the life of any. It's a different
days.
Movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Different movie. You have 34 days. You have a shot list with 10 shots.
Yeah.
Suddenly you have to turn that into 3 shots. You can't pick your 3 favorite out of that 10.
Yeah.
You got to get coverage at that point.
Yeah.
And there were scenes in there that were oneers that were not intended to be oneers.
Yeah.
And, you know, late at night, the clock's ticking. It was a Canadian crew. They do not do overtime there.
They're walking.
Yeah. 6 o'clock. We're walking, eh?
Yeah. 12 hours, eh? I'm out of here.
We're Uda here.
Yeah. They'll call you sir, but they'll walk out.
Yeah.
And, so, I mean, man.
And sorry. We're sorry about that, but that's the reality of it. Okay.
Those are the rules up here, sorry.
So, I mean, and Coogan and I were like, well, you know, what's the worst that can happen? I mean, for him, of course, Coogan was like, what's the worst that can happen? I'm a fucking comedy legend, and I'll be fine.
Yeah, sure.
For me, it was such a nightmare. It was so hard. God, it was so hard. I mean, it was a trial. It was not the biggest trial in my life.
Okay.
I was lucky enough to have a bigger one a little bit after that that was real.
Okay.
But in terms of career stuff, I was on suicide watch. I mean, it was just like bad.
Did it make you not want to direct anymore?
Yeah.
Kevin and I were talking about that in the car on the way over here. This business, it's literally up, down. It's good news, bad news. Good news, bad news. Bad news, bad news, bad news, bad news. Good news, bad news.
No news, bad news.
And you know that one of those bad news runs is not going to end, potentially. I mean, and then you'll be like, okay, I guess it's like a basketball player. You know, at some point it's just like, well, I guess I'm done, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought I was.
No, there's always second acts.
I started directing commercials. I started doing whatever I could to stay kind of in the industry. But at the same time as I was making that shit show, which, by the way, I have a great affection for it. It becomes
a great memory and a great story and a great experience.
Absolutely.
I can go
toe-to-toe with anybody's indie film nightmare experience.
Sure.
So I got that. I also probably –
Well, it's also – you know, it's funny because it's like I have a couple projects going with like younger writers.
Yeah.
And it's also the time when if they even whine for a second, I'll be like, look, kid – Right. Hold on a
second.
Shut your fucking
mouth.
I've been through fucking everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Perseverance is all you got. It's the only thing you can bring to the table sometimes. So at the same time, though, I sold a TV show.
Okay.
It was totally random. I had no TV experience.
Yeah.
TV is something that...
It's a spec script that you wrote? Or you pitched it?
It was a pitch.
Yeah.
And television is got this hierarchy to it that I've always really liked.
Yeah.
Because, people start off as a staff writer or even as a writer's assistant, and you kind of work your way. It's like it's military rank. You go from story editor, executive story editor, co-producer.
All along building your resume.
You're building these titles. But there is one loophole.
Yeah.
That if you walk in and you sell a show.
Yeah.
You could become the creator of
right,
the thing.
Right. And that's how you jump the line.
That's how you jump the right. line.
If yeah. they let you, that's a hard jump to make.
I was very lucky, and I had some good partners involved, people from X-Files. David Duchovny and Rob Bowman were my partners on it.
Good partners to have.
Very good partners to have. And Channing Dungey, who is now the head of ABC, was our executive at the time, and she was great. What happened was the writer's strike happened in the middle of this.
Yeah.
And it killed the
That's the other conversation we had. Hollywood comes up with the most original ways to fuck you every time.
Yeah. Just when you and what also was happening by then right around then was the payroll company went under.
Oh, holy shit. Yeah, I know.
Remember that?
Well, we were shooting Slam and Salmon.
Yeah.
And they went bankrupt in the middle of a shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have those payroll companies, you have to give them an escrow account. You have to put like $400,000 into an escrow account so that they have the money to pay out your people. We put that money into the bank, and then they went fucking bankrupt.
Yep.
And we were out, $500,000 on a $3 million movie.
Yep.
I mean, that's a shitload of fucking money.
By the way, it's one of these original ways to get fucked where it's like, then.
I remember it well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I paid for Molly Shannon out of my RD and I paid for Molly Shannon.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and Bob I think threw in a little bit too there.
The funny thing is, it's like
Axiom was the company? I can't remember.
Axiom.
It was a nightmare.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
I'm hearing the story and I've got a smile on my face. I should be not happy to hear, but I have a smile on my face. I'm like, we've all been through that.
But it was that warm bile moment though, back in the time when I was like, oh my god, we were on the set. I remember it was like. We don't have the money to pay the cast and crew. And you're like, what?
Well, it's
the
like
the company went bankrupt. What?
Yeah.
It's like when you're like already like you're in it. It's a 300. You got your back up against the wall. You're going to fight everybody, and something falls from the ceiling, and you're like, wait a second. That's not cool.
I had my Vaseline all over my
totally
body.
I was prepared for this.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
So you kind of pivoted over to TV and sold the show, and that changed your fortunes a little bit, or
it changed my fortunes to some extent. But more than anything, it was like I could have a career here.
Yeah.
These people are normal.
Yeah.
They're not thieves.
Yeah.
It's a business. There was something about it that was very grounding for me.
There's
stability to it. Yeah. And even though the writer's strike killed that project, it opened that world to me to some extent. And I kind of just pulled myself up and I wrote a spec script, very, very different from the one the X-Files guys were helping me with, which was a sci-fi thing.
Yeah.
This thing called The Running Mate that was a political satire, an hour-long thing. And it was what I wanted to write. Nobody was over my shoulder. Nobody gave a shit about me.
Yeah.
My agents didn't remember my name. and I wrote this thing and it was good. I had always written to direct, even at Colgate.
Yeah.
I had written things only to direct them, knowing that I could fix my...
It's a mindset. It's a certain mindset to write that way,
And
what we do,
I had written things in between, but nothing ever, to make. It was film school stuff. And so this was sort of like the first time I actually fell in love with writing.
Yeah.
And the process of it and being alone in a room and creating a world. And
did that put you into like kind of the – did you have to go into the lower levels of writing or you kept trying to sell your own shows?
Well, out of that, I did not –
I mean you had to start at the bottom or did you – when you started getting into these shows?
Nearly.
Yeah.
I mean not so much the bottom, and that came later.
Yeah.
What first happened was – I had no my agents had no idea what to do with this script.
Right.
They kept on sending me to network shows.
Yeah.
And I wasn't a network person.
Sure.
I think it was Graham Yost who did get the script, and he brought me in for Justified.
Right,
he
loved him. Loved Justified.
He gave me the confidence. I was sitting in the waiting room, and he came out for this meeting, and he looked at me. He's like, Jonathan fucking Glenn. Jonathan fucking... He must have repeated it five
times. Did he know you from somewhere? Did he,
no. No, okay. It was just because he dug the script.
Okay.
And it was like, who the fuck are you?
Right.
And he was like,
I'm the creator
so
of Justified.
That's right. No, he was saying, who the fuck are you?
Yeah, to me.
And it was, there was a number of people that kind of helped me kind of dig out of this. But I still wasn't getting my script read. And Amber Tamblyn was one of the cast members from a previous incarnation of the movie, the featured Safety Glass, who I had to let go from being attached to it because I had to hire Hilary Duff to be in it, who did a great job.
Okay.
But at the time, I was...
The powers that be were making that decision?
Okay,
got it.
And I also knew what that entailed, which meant that even though she wasn't the lead, she was going to be on the poster. And Steve Coogan is this brilliant guy, and if your listeners don't know Steve Coogan's work, great times ahead of you. Watch
The Trip and
The Trip or Alan Partridge stuff. Mm-hmm.
24-Hour Party People and all kinds of great movies. Yeah,
yes, sure. And actually was in with some of the guys I worked with in London. They've worked together as well. And so Amber Tamblyn, I called her up, and I hung up because I was like, what am I doing? What is Amber going to do for me?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I mean, and the last conversation I had with her was I'm sorry.
Yeah. You're fired.
Yeah. there wasn't even anything to fire her from at that point. It was just like, I need to go this direction because there may be money here. I mean, it was the most awkward conversation. Yeah. And I hung up and I was just so fucking depressed. I called, I tried to call my best friend, and Siri fucking connected me back to Amber Tamblyn.
So this time you thought the phone was ringing and your friend was going to pick up the phone.
And it was Amber.
Yeah.
And she was like in a dentist office waiting. And she was just so cool, so nice, so glad to hear from me. And I was like, well, I got this script and I just want someone to read it. And she was like, yeah, I'll read it tonight. And she fucking did.
Wow.
And she gave it, she loved it, and she gave it to her boyfriend at the time, David Cross, who loved it and wanted to do it, wanted to be in it, wanted to be the lead. He was perfect for it.
Yeah.
And he was at CAA at the time. CAA's head of lit, this guy Joe Cohen, read it.
Yeah, we know Joe Cohen.
Our buddy Joe Cohen.
Yeah,
he sold our first TV show for
us. No kidding.
Yeah.
Joe Cohen saved my life.
Yeah. Great guy.
And that's kind of how it happened, you know, a couple months later. But I reached out to Joe.
Joe Cohen actually saved our lives,
too. He did save our lives.
Yeah. He saved a lot of lives,
our
actually.
First TV show in the room to NBC.
And I'll just quickly tell the story. Like, it was our last pitch. We had been passed on already by UPN. So we were feeling pretty low.
The old days.
We were renting Ted Griffin's house.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Sleeping two in a bed.
Yeah.
You know?
Maybe
and
more.
Literally, we were on our last financial legs. I wouldn't be surprised if, like, this thing hadn't gone down if we had tucked tail and run for the business. But, like, there was a sniff. There was a whiff of enthusiasm at NBC. And he said,
it was the end of day. The last
one. It was a cloudy day,
too. It was like
too.
5 o'clock in the afternoon.
He said, guys, get out. He said, let's do this. Let's do the deal. And he's like, guys, leave the room. Go outside.
That's
outside.
Amazing. Wow. Yeah. That's
he was
so
in the
Joe.
Pitch with us. Yeah.
He was in the pitch. And then we
get
left.
Out. He's like, go. I got to talk.
Yeah, get out. And literally pushed us out. And like we were out in the parking lot. We're like, what's going on? He came out. He's like, I fucking sold it. We're like, what? Because UPN had passed on us. We're like, nobody's NBC's not going to buy it.
That's him. Yeah. I mean, and there's, you know, there's nobody else quite like that in the business.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a champion.
He's great.
And he sees people's talent and he connects them with each other. It's almost like a rep company that he's got. And he's, you know, he's got Terrence Winter, you know, Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah.
He's got Michelle Ashford, who did Masters of Sex. And, he had the guys who did Bloodline.
Yeah.
And so that's how I got Bloodline.
Okay.
He's also
the guy who put us together with Landgraf, with John Landgraf. Landgraf was running Michael Shamrock, Danny DeVito's company at the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we were trying to get Super Troopers made, and he put us together with Landgraf, and we started that relationship
That's
with John
great.
Landgraf.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I feel like, you know, people listening to this, it's like we have to sweep up after all the names we're dropping here, but these are the people that you need in your career, and also, I think, to some extent, in your life to keep giving you hope.
Yeah.
Joe used to call me at like, and this was before I got Bloodline. He used to call me at like 9:30 at night.
Yeah.
11 o'clock at night. Here's what you got to do. Here's who you got to be. This is what you got to do. And just like give me these lectures. I'm like, John, go home. He's like, I am home. I'm in my driveway.
Yeah.
Like, well, go in the door, Jim.
No, but look, this is as much as the industry can fuck you in original ways, and as much as there's bad news and good news, there are also something about showbiz is sometimes there's good fortune too.
Yes.
And in terms of your representation or somebody who has faith in you, that is, you know, we've had some in our lives. You're just like, God, I wish they could all be like this guy.
Yeah.
And Joe Cohen was a guy like we also personable. Like we just liked the guy and his enthusiasm.
Yeah, good guy. Yeah. And so that directed you into Bloodline.
That directed me into Bloodline. Okay. And so
Bloodline. People, I mean, have you seen Bloodline?
I saw the first.
I watched
few
the first
episodes.
Season and a half. So I've watched into the middle of second season. But you only did first season, or
I only did the first season.
Okay.
I actually haven't seen the later seasons.
Okay. And it's a Netflix show. And it's basically about this kind of, I guess you'd say, dysfunctional family in the Keys.
I would say they're dysfunctional.
Yeah, they're pretty fucking dysfunctional.
Where they have, you know, but it's a beautiful show. It's a very kind of dreamlike show and very cinematic, very filmic TV show.
Yeah. Daniel Zellman, Glenn Kessler, and his brother Todd Kessler were the three guys who created it.
And they were the Damages guys?
They were the Damages guys. Yeah. Former actors, all of them. And so they were terrific to work with.
And how did they – did you have to go in and give them writing samples and present yourself in that manner? Or?
Yeah. Funnily enough, the writing sample that was working for me that got me Joe was not the one that got me the gig. It was another feature script that I had written that was more thrillery.
Yeah.
And that got me the gig.
Yeah.
Which I actually liked in some ways because it was like I wasn't a one-trick pony in that way.
Right. And then did you have to go – like. Did you guys work here, or were you guys down in the Keys? Or
no,
because you shot on location.
It was a bit chaotic. We had a room here.
Yeah,
me and Glenn and a couple other guys. We've been dropping so many names, so you guys will have to forgive me for listening.
Keep going, keep dropping. That's why the true crew listens to this shit.
But how many people are on the staff?
It was three of us in L.A. and then. Todd and Daniel and another guy, Arthur Phillips, brilliant guy, grand champion of Jeopardy, actually.
Really?
Yeah. All these guys went to Harvard. They were all just like these brilliant fucking guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Harvard.
And then there were me and this other guy from New Jersey that we and I grew up together.
Right.
I got there the first day. I realized that he was a fucker who used to push me into lockers.
So you knew him?
I knew him.
That's hysterical.
Yeah, I saw him walking down the hallway and I was like, oh, God.
He's going to push me into a locker.
Sort of like,
you got a sense memory?
Reptilian brain kind of took over and I just started cowering.
You got in the locker.
Yeah. I'll just get in.
Let me save you the trouble.
Excuse me. But it must have been weird, like, you know, I find this interesting. I went and worked on a TV show the other day, and you walk into a scenario that's already created with a group of people who are already running that situation, as opposed to us who self-create and you self-create. And you must have walked into that Bloodline situation with those people already in place then.
No. That was the great thing about Bloodline. I walked in. I was I think I was the first hired for as a writer, and there weren't very many. I think it was even fewer at the beginning. They had a pitch that they sold to Netflix. It was everybody in town wanted it, whatever.
Yeah.
And they scrapped the pitch. And so we really were starting from scratch. And I was able to write three of the episodes that first season. I contributed to others as well. And it was a real lab of like trying to figure out how to make this thing. And you know, it's a crazy thing. It's on the show that I'm on now as well is a brand new show, and you're sitting there and you're writing a character and you're trying to have them, you know, what's their voice?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, my opinion of what their voice is has to be somehow melded with my boss's opinion of what his voice is, and my boss's opinion of his voice is not yet formed yet either.
Yeah.
Right. And let me say this. Do you have actors at that point? Because that's got to enter in it also.
We did not have actors at Bloodline at that point.
Because, I mean, the cast is amazing.
Yeah. Ben
Shepard and Ben Mendelsohn is amazing. Kyle Chandler and Linda Cardellini. And
Sissy Spacek.
And so, you know, that's got to kind of influence you also when you're...
Absolutely.
If you're writing for Sam Shepard, I mean, you got to fucking...
Yes.
I mean, you're probably a huge Sam Shepard fan.
I was.
I hated him.
I was not a huge Sam Shepard fan.
No,
why not? Why not?
I respected Sam Shepard for what he was doing, but it somehow it was kind of like Edward Albee had a. If you know, I'm comparing these two guys, and that's probably not fair. They're very different, but sort of. Edward Albee's a little bit older, but not much. Similar eras of kind of experimental theater, but Edward Albee had a sense of humor.
Okay.
that was dark and delicious and fucking, you know, almost a musicality to him.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And when I was directing his stuff, you could be as crazy as you wanted to be. And then Shepard's stuff is just a bit of a slog.
Yeah, yeah.
And like Barry Child.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, kind of gives it away with the title.
right.
Everything's on a spectrum. And his sweet spot was a little bit far off.
Different than yours.
A little bit different from mine. Yeah, yeah. It was a little bit too much.
Were you feeling this way while you're still in the genesis stages of the show?
With Sam Shepard?
Yeah.
It's my opinion today of Sam Shepard. You know, I mean, that's of his place.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert. He doesn't last that long on the show.
Yeah. No,
just a spoiler alert.
Yeah.
And I think it's because of Glatzer. No. But so you're writing these early episodes. You don't have anyone cast. It's true. I don't have any cast. So you're trying to create these characters.
Yeah. I mean, the cast came together really fast. These guys from Damages, you know, where they had an incredible cast as well. They brought a cast together lickety split. But I still didn't know how they were going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't know what Ben Mendelsohn was going to bring to it.
Sure.
And we all really kind of brought our childhood and our families to it. There's a lot of talk about, you know, I have a relationship with my brother that's very good, you know, but there were years where we weren't talking to each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, a writer's room is group therapy.
Start mining that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's no hiding in a writer's room.
Yeah.
After a while. And you think for the first couple weeks, like, oh, I got this.
Yeah.
And then around week three, your insecurities start to come. You say something, and it's like that night at 3 a.m. You're like, "Oh fuck, why did I?" And now they're all thinking, "Oh," and you know,
those slap happy moments and the loopy moments in the writer's room.
And then, and you know, by the way, you apply that to the guys at Better Call Saul, Breaking Bad guys, and you know, it gets more amplified.
Let me ask you this, because this is kind of interesting to me too. Is like, you know, it's this inception of these binge watching shows and the way that we watch TV these days. Now, as you're working on Bloodline, is it in your mind that it's going to be presented differently than TV shows in past history? And do you write in a different way because of that situation?
I think we all wanted to do something different. I think the KZK guys, that's their company's name. They absolutely wanted to, you know, break molds.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we had that experience in the sense that we had a show we sold to HBO recently.
Yeah.
And
congratulations.
Well, it's dead. It's dead now.
Okay.
It's dead.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing at the time
was recently and it's dead already.
Well, we sold it, whatever, maybe a year
ago.
And then there was a hierarchy change HBO and we were with the old hierarchy and then
Got
the hierarchy came in. But the interesting thing to us was that, you know, we wrote a pilot script in a kind of a way that we think that it should work or whatever.
Right.
And we presented the script to HBO, their position was, hey, slow it down, man. Slow it down, right? You don't have to put so much into this first episode. Stretch it out.
That's right.
You know, slow it down. And we were like, wait, what? What are you talking about? We want to have this joke, and it's going to go like this, this, or this. And they're like, no, just take it slow.
Yeah.
And we're like, okay. And we never really thought in that way.
Yeah.
And Bloodline is a show that I think of that has that they have a very kind of slow it down feel to it.
Absolutely.
Well, but on the
which is kind of adds to the dreamlike sense of it, I feel like, you know what I mean?
On the flip side, though,
it's hard to get into it.
That was always my problem with some HBO shows.
Right.
Even The Wire, which I loved, I always found that I loved it because I was able to binge watch it.
But that's my point.
By episode 8, it would be great. But like Breaking Bad, which I binged watched.
Yeah.
Was every episode ended with a cliffhanger.
That's
yes.
Right. As soon as those pants went up in the air and the pilot of Breaking Bad was like, I'm in.
Yeah, you're in. Yeah.
I was sold. And
I often think that, but I'm saying that that's the mindset now where you're like, look, I know people are going to watch it this way. Like, they're going to finish this episode and not have gotten enough out of it, and they're just going to start the new episode.
No, but true. Except that when we were writing that, we were annoyed at that because we were like, we have so many things that we want to do.
Right.
And Breaking Bad is a show that, like, they don't do that with. They accept their foot is on the gas.
Well, I don't know. It was a combination. The subject matter was so hot, and it was the premise was something that you can really kind of encapsulate. And you know, school teacher, chemistry teacher turns into meth. You know, Mr. Chips to Scarface was Vince Gilligan's premise. So it was a great, great premise that they fed off of. But character-wise, they took their time.
Yeah,
you know, they really did. And
but as you're sitting in the writer's room of Bloodline, are you saying that to yourself? It's like, just we don't have to do. We don't have to reveal.
I think with Bloodline, there was a constant debate among among us all about how fast we should go. And it really is a conversation that continued. It was a big conversation for Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
You know, how fast.
Which I want to definitely.
Well, you guys slow that one down.
Slow the fuck out of that. Yeah. Yeah. Because.
But that's a different situation.
It's a super because
you've actually earned the right to slow it down.
Well, because you know where you end up, and you're building the anticipation by slowing it down, which is an interesting concept, I feel like.
Yeah, it's funny. There's so many reviews that talk about how the writers in the writer's room must be giggling at what they're doing to the audience, how they're teasing them to death.
Well, because it's like, look, let's throw this character that everybody knows in for the first time. And you're like, it's Laval Crawford.
It's funny, though, because the two shows that I'm working on now, Bliss is this thing that I'm doing with David Cross. And obviously he's coming from comedy background and particularly
with Odenkirk. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Coincidental.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Coincidental.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, which was lovely in a way.
Unless they're sharing notes about you.
What do you think about Glatzer? Oh, I don't know about
Glatzer. Hey, I got that guy Glatzer. I got that guy Glatzer working on my show. Oh, yeah, that guy.
Oh, Glatzer.
Oh, yeah.
Can only hope that those two guys could be trash talking you. Like, if they're just talking about
you. That would be great. Wouldn't it be great?
You're talking about the Mob Dennis kid? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But with both that and now on this new show, Succession, the writer, the creator of it he and his partner did Peep Show.
Okay.
Which, if you guys don't know, you got to know. It's on Netflix. It's arguably the most talked about and influential sitcom, if you could even call it a sitcom, in England, in the UK.
Okay.
It's hugely influential. They do pub quizzes there.
Uh-huh.
And I went in for a pub quiz with actually David Cross, and the subject for everybody in the pub that everybody would know was the show Peep Quiz.
Hilarious. Okay.
Peep Show. Okay. He also worked on Veep, and he a couple of features was nominated for an Oscar.
Wait, what's his name?
His name is Jesse Armstrong.
Okay.
And you know, I've been very, 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 very fucking fortunate to work with a couple of geniuses.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll put Vince Gilligan in there.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But this guy's one of them, too.
Okay.
He's really, really good and funny and just an amazingly lovely guy. And then the other writers were all veterans of Veep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which
I did an episode of Veep.
I know you did.
Yeah.
You're very good.
Those people.
That was nice to watch.
They were good people.
That was a great moment.
Armando Iannucci. Yeah. Yes. He was great.
You know, it was a great group of people, but they most of them had come out of comedy, and just in terms of what you're talking about with your own show, with the HBO show, is the pacing coming out of comedy is how do you do it? How do you do 60 minutes now? How do you do drama with this is the thing that we're doing, the Succession show is basically it's not a correct log line for it, but everybody uses it, so I'll use it. It's sort of like a Murdoch type of family.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's a fair bit of satire in how we present them, but it's fundamentally a dysfunctional family story.
Yeah.
And so the metabolic rate of how the story was digested was something that we talked about all the time there.
Yeah.
So, but let's back it up. Let's back it up again. Because all right. So Bloodline. You're on Bloodline. How did you do one season?
I did the one season.
Yeah. And then.
Well, what happened was just as I was getting Bloodline, I'll tell this story because it's good for people. It's a little bit of inspiration maybe. But I was a huge Breaking Bad fan.
Yeah.
Massive.
Yeah.
And I started it pretty early on. I didn't catch the pilot, but I was into it by the end of the first season. And, and sort of saw it as, oh, this, you can do this.
Yeah.
You can do this. And and I hadn't had that feeling from Mad Men. I hadn't had that feeling from other things
Agreed.
Even the Sopranos. Yeah. This was me. I felt like I got.
Did you watch The Wire?
Yeah, sure. And loved it. So I was listening to Peter Gould, who was my other boss at Better Call Saul, and Tom Schnauz. Breaking Bad was just finishing up, and they were doing an episode of Fresh Air. And Peter Gould, who's always been really honest about how tough it is in this business and how he went for many years going doing the up and down thing, and how he was living in an apartment with his daughter and his wife, and he got this. He's telling a story about how he got the break to be on Breaking Bad, mm-hmm. and I had just gotten the Bloodline deal, and I had, you know, gone through this whole thing with the feature that was a nightmare and all of this shit. And, you know, about 2 years of, like, doing webisodes and doing whatever I could to kind of keep food on the table.
Yeah.
You know, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard this story that Peter told, and I had gotten this now – this new gig, and I had gotten Joe Cohen into my life, and it felt like there was a future. And I just – I pulled over to the side of the road, and I just started fucking – like, everything just kind of poured out.
Really?
Just
okay.
Like, because you just put that shit on a shelf. You
sure.
put it on a shelf. You put it on a shelf. You just keep putting the fear and the uncertainty and the disappointments and the rejections on shelves because that's where they belong.
Yeah.
If you put them front and center, you're fucked.
You're fucked, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're fucked.
You can't continue.
You can't continue.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in this moment – the shelves just kind of collapsed under the weight of this emotional moment.
Right.
And I had just had a son, and I was living in this apartment with my wife.
Yeah.
And it was just like
– trying to figure out what the paycheck is going to be.
And, these guys who were, you know, kind of heroes of mine
sure.
you know, as TV writers. And anyway, when the contract came through with Bloodline – Joe called me and he's like, so great, you know, we've got the contract for Bloodline. This is, you know, you're going to be this and you're going to be making that. And it was great conversation.
Sure.
Like, oh, and by the way, Peter Gould and Melissa Bernstein is the executive producer of Saul and Breaking Bad. They read your spec script and they loved it. And I'd love to meet with you because there's an opening on Better Call Saul. So this would have been season one for Better Call
okay.
Saul.
Okay.
And of course it was in the newspapers and everybody was knowing that this was
that
coming.
That was coming, yeah.
And he's like, but you know, we'll try to set up a general with you. You're doing Bloodline, and I was like, wait a second, can we just back up,
right, a hair there.
You know, I'm first of all delighted that they read and loved the script. That's fucking great. But can't I? He's like, no, you're doing Bloodline.
Yeah,
and so, and I don't mean to in any way diss the Bloodline.
Yeah,
situation,
but I mean, you know, that was it was a personal,
right?
Yeah.
And so then after Bloodline ended, there was another opening at Saul.
Okay.
And we connected.
And did you watch the first season?
I watched the first season. Yeah. Actually, at that point, it hadn't come out yet. So I watched
Okay.
You know, with the –
preemptively watched it.
It was,
so you were the first person to watch it, weren't you?
I think I was probably one of the first fans certainly to watch it. Of Breaking Bad fans, yeah.
Okay.
I guess I really was actually.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, everybody in the office was a fan of Breaking Bad as well, but I was an outsider.
And were you thinking to yourself, slow burn. Really slow burn on this
Which
show.
One? Better Call Saul?
Yeah, season one.
Well, you know, season one, they were finding their legs still. You know, they were finding
– I don't care what they're – I mean, I've talked about it in this podcast. That's my favorite show on TV.
That's brilliant.
And because, you know, I think it's funny. I think it was – I think it's funnier than Breaking Bad, personally.
Yeah.
I think – Jonathan Banks is fucking great.
He is fucking
and I, you know, the problem here with this is the guy who makes the sausage. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I'm gonna say some shit. And he's gonna be like, in his mind, he's like, that's not really true.
No.
Jonathan Banks is fucking great. And
I'll tell you a funny story about Banks.
And Odin Kirk's fucking dick.
It's like when I said, you know, I like Breaking Bad. Each episode ends with a cliffhanger. He's like, no, I disagree. So like, right, I can't really disagree.
No, I didn't disagree that it didn't hit with a cliffhanger. It's just the pace of it. They took their time.
Yeah.
I was not excited about Better Call Saul. I was like, spin-off,
right. Yeah,
something
sure.
stupid idea. It's another one of those things also where, like, I don't like movies like The Alamo, where, like, I know what is going to happen
right.
in The Alamo.
Right.
I know what's going to happen, so right. it's not going right. to enjoyable to me.
Right.
And I'm like, but I'll watch it,
yeah.
you know? And from the first couple episodes, I was like, fuck, this is fucking great.
Yeah. It's a weird thing, because we're in collusion with the audience.
Yes.
Because they know what's happening to this character, and it's a weird show. You
yeah.
know? It was the first thing that Jenny Hutcheson was, one of the senior writers on the show, she said that to me in the beginning. She's like, it's a weird show.
Yeah.
This is a weird show.
Well, but it's not weird. It's unique in that
yes,
because
sure.
of Breaking Bad and because there's, number one, a trust established with Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
also because you know what happens down the road
right.
to a certain degree.
But there's also, like, there's this stink of, like, Vince and Vince is probably he's at the point where he can do whatever he wants to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, nobody's going to walk in and say, you can't do that shit.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had it so many times where, you know, you write something or shoot something and it goes through these executives and that thing and blah, 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 yeah. and then you, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you watch that thing and you're like, oh, he wants to unfold the scene backwards or he wants to start with this more obscure element and then get to this. And you're like, oh, that's fucking great because
yeah,
he can't.
But that's what
and
I mean.
He's smart enough to be able to do
that's
it.
That's what I'm
yeah.
saying. There's a trust that's been established
yeah.
by Breaking Bad
yeah.
within the industry.
Yeah.
as well as for the audience. You know, so for me, it's like watching season one of Better Call Saul. It was that moment like, oh, this is how it's going to go. And I appreciate it because I trust them. I know what's happening. Oh, they're not just going to go right there. They're gonna unpeel this onion so fucking slowly. And it makes sense because in life, things just don't happen like that. You know, things do happen slowly.
Yeah, it's true enough. So long as it's not – doesn't feel like paint drying, you know, or life.
Right.
You
know? Yeah.
Right.
But it does – you know, there's got to be a sense of the real.
But well, it's a fine balance because we know where you're going.
Yeah.
And it's how slow are you going to take us to get there? It's going to be, what, six seasons or whatever, seven seasons, yeah, or whatever it's going to be. So we have to know.
Something
John,
about
– he knows, by the way.
I don't know if he knows. That's my other question. No. How much do you really know?
Oh, no, he knows.
I do know what we're – what I can't say we anymore. It's they are planning.
Yeah.
But there was never anything set in stone. And the way that in Breaking Bad as well, they go beat by beat, brick by brick. So even within each episode – the first beat is discovered, and the second beat is completely dependent on what that first beat is, and onward.
Yeah.
So you have a notion. You speak sort of globally about what the episode might be or what the season might be. I don't think that we ever – I mean, the percentage of the times that we actually hit the thing that we talked about hitting is pretty low. Sometimes those things that we talked about hitting ended up being several episodes later. Sometimes they didn't happen at all.
Yeah.
But – we knew that those global conversations were, you know, blue skying it, and we're not. This is not. We're not setting things down.
Okay.
In any kind of way. So it was a very organic.
It was so organic. Because like I'll tell you this, Cinnabon Gene passed out in like episode one of the season, and then we never saw him again.
That's correct.
So what I mean, you
Cinnabon
know,
Gene.
Do you want him to spoil it for you?
Well, no. I mean, it's like
he knows.
Like, well, what I'm saying is like that can't have been the plan going into the season,
Kevin,
where we were going to see him.
Like you have stopped trusting these people.
No. I'm just curious. I'm curious of the process because, like, they must know the story of Cinnabon Gene, right? That's the story that none of us know.
Right.
That's the story none of us know.
They know it.
That hasn't happened yet, right?
By the way, the person sitting right next to you knows.
That's what I'm trying to find out. if he does know, because
here, Kevin.
When you're creating a season, you don't have the guy pass out in like episode two and then never come back to him again the whole season.
No, I think that's fair. But
why?
But mind you, Gene shows up in the first minutes of season one, season two, and season three.
Right.
That's the pattern.
But isn't he in later episodes in season one and two?
Kev, let me just tell you this.
He is. In season three, he shows up again.
Let me just tell you this. Having corresponded with Jonathan Glatzer.
Yeah.
I know that he knows the answers to all your questions.
I know, but I'm talking about more the he just brought up the organic process of writing the show, that you have the beats, but sometimes you don't get to those beats because you're doing other stuff, right? So maybe
– it's very likely. I'd say it's likely
that
if I were to write down what I know and then as the seasons unfold, it is very likely that what I write down is not going to be accurate or it will be a
it'll take have that, Lemmy.
It'll have a resemblance.
Right.
I feel
that,
pretty
Lemmy,
sure.
Lemmy, you son of a bitch.
Listen, he's being nice. He fucking knows. He knows that person right there knows exactly how many seasons. You know why I know? Because he told me how many seasons.
Well, we know how many seasons. It's been announced.
I think it was announced.
Yeah. Oh, good.
I was careful to not.
Well, it's an interesting thing because talking about this, I was in the middle of season three. I reached out because I was like, I'm so impressed. Really, it's like Jonathan Glatzer is a producer on these things, and it was you and I first spoke right before I got to episode four, season three, Sabrosito,
which is written
by Jonathan Glatzer.
That's a great episode because
thank you.
I love the. I like the Hector Nacho Jonathan Banks episode.
All that
a
shit.
Lot.
Yeah. So
a
like
lot.
So that's
a fucking right dialogue for Gus and Hector. I mean,
that's great.
That shit just.
But so that's my question. Like, is it when you're sitting in the writer's room and did they say you're going to write episode four? Do they say which episode do you want to write? Or they say episode four. These are the beats we need to hit in episode four.
It was always. Sometimes it was said in advance. Sometimes it wasn't. I can't quite recall. It was usually sort of done hierarchically. So Tom Schnauz and Jenny Hutcheson were usually ahead of me in the pecking order, or Vincent Peter, as it was in season three. So in season two, I wrote the third one, and in this one, I wrote the fourth one because Vincent Peter wrote the first one. So it was kind of you go down the –
Everyone gets a turn.
Everyone gets a turn. You kind of go down the pecking order, which is an interesting thing because, you know, while it's a nice nod to whatever title you've achieved in your career to be, you know, given that third or fourth slot or whatever it is, oftentimes the best episodes come later.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The eights and the nines and the
– Well, even the sixes and the sevens. Yeah, yeah. And then usually as it – It was in the two seasons I was there, the Breaking Bad vets wrote two episodes.
Yeah.
So they did come back for one of those seven, eights, or nines. But yeah. Sometimes those are the best episodes.
Yeah.
You know? Is there ever a time where you're like, you know that you're slotted to bring Lavelle Crawford back? Like you're like, I get to write Lavelle Crawford. And then they're like, you know, we actually think we should give this one to the Hutch, to Jenny Hutch. And then you're like, oh, motherfucker, she always gets –
Sure, there's always a bit of that.
But and like Bloodline, though, there was a situation where you walked into a pre-established room. I mean, yep. Bloodline, you didn't, but for right. this, you did.
Yeah, oh, very
like
much
you walked
so,
into
yeah.
this room and it was set and there were
it
people.
It was dramatically – Breaking Bad was foremost on my mind walking in that first day and never really went away in a lot of ways. The show is a legacy of Breaking Bad, so it was always there. The greatest show in television.
And you're walking into this room where these people have already done the first season.
And when I first walked in, I was the only outsider.
Yeah,
everybody else was a Breaking Bad.
That's rough.
Well, it was a kind of thing where I was like, okay, I'm going to embrace this role.
Yeah.
And I actually said to Peter, I was like, look, I there's no way I'm going to catch up to you guys in terms of intimacy with these characters.
Yeah.
I never will. And maybe I shouldn't try, and maybe I should just be sort of a little bit more of the devil's advocate in the room, the outsider, you know, that sort of thing. And I said to him, I was like, but mind you, everyone thinks the devil's advocate is an asshole.
Right.
So so I'm telling you this in advance.
Right. I'm not an asshole.
I'm not an asshole.
But I'm going to be an asshole.
I'm going to be a bit of an asshole.
Right.
And so occasionally I'd get into it with them. Occasionally it was about pacing. Occasionally, you know, the conversations that happen in a writer's room, any creative cauldron is going to have these, you know, these headbutting moments, but never was it anything other than constructive.
Sure.
Creative. Except for that one time.
Oh, shit.
Well, is it like
is that the Jonathan Banks story?
No. It's not the Jonathan Banks.
Will you tell me the Jonathan Banks story?
Well.
and tell me how the series ends, too.
Well, a good Banks story. He was nominated and absolutely deserved to win the Emmy.
Yeah,
first best supporting actor
this last time.
Yeah.
He's the fucking man.
He's the guy who won was actually Ben Mendelsohn from Bloodline.
Oh, wow. Okay, great.
And Mendelsohn won primarily for his work in season one because he's not so much in season two.
He's not. Spoiler alert.
Right. Yeah, we can't. Yeah.
But because
it's tough to.
But it's interesting because the way people experience Netflix, it's not really like this season. It's just I started watching Bloodline.
When I did.
And then I voted because that's just how it happened. So he kind of won in a way. I mean, nobody said as much, but it's evident. And Banks threatened to punch me in the heart
because you wrote that, Mendelsohn.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. God damn it.
And was it terrifying when he said
that? Did you shit your pants a little bit when he said that?
He's always got it. We call each other Johnny.
Yeah.
He's a lovely, lovely guy. Such a sentimentalist. It's crazy. I'll tell you this.
He's had an amazing career.
Extraordinary.
You think
career,
about like the first time I ever was aware
Wise
of him was
guys.
Beverly
Wise
Hills.
Guys.
Beverly Hills Cop was for me.
Wise Guys was fucking great.
True. Yeah.
Did you like him in Beverly Hills Cop?
Yeah, I liked him in that too. I liked him in that too.
So I'll tell you a little bit of this story. I don't want to get too much into it, but when I first came to Saul, and it was so many ways, you know, it was the pinnacle of everything that I'd been kind of working for, at least in television.
Yeah.
It was where I wanted to be, and all of my friends and colleagues, you know, hated me in the nicest of ways. And a few weeks into it, this health crisis, this major, major health crisis happened in my family.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, like overnight.
Yeah.
Everything that we've been talking about for the past however long we've been talking, career stuff just didn't fucking matter.
It becomes less important, yeah.
Less important. It became my it became the path for health insurance.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And what that was the first sort of reaction of it was just like, you know, and then I had to take a couple weeks out of the room. And as it turns out, I was actually going out of the room anyway to write my script. So I actually wrote episode 203 in the hospital.
Okay.
In a cafeteria in the hospital. Yeah. And then for the next several months, I was commuting from a hospital room to the,
in Albuquerque?
No. We were here in Burbank.
Okay.
Commuting to a hospital from a hospital directly to the room.
Yeah.
It sounds like insanity. I mean, I was sleeping on an air mattress, and I'll say this much. You know, when Jimmy Kimmel did his thing about his son, at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, I was weeping right along with
him. Right, sure.
And that's a great, great fucking place, and there's some great, great people there.
And
just to cut to a little bit of that punchline, things are okay.
Okay,
now.
Good.
Okay,
but yeah, I mean, I was in this situation where I was writing a script in a hospital cafeteria. And it was going to go one of two ways. I was either going to break into pieces,
you know,
just have to bow out. And Vince and Peter and Melissa Bernstein, they were amazing during this time. And they actually said to me, you know, if you want to bow out of this season, it won't affect you for next season. Do what you got to do. By the time that conversation had happened, I had already started my script, and I already realized that I absolutely needed this.
I needed
to go into a fictional world. Every day.
Yeah.
And write this dialogue that had nothing to do with what I was dealing with.
Sure.
And it was it made me a better writer because it stripped away a lot of the prima donna shit that everybody has.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. The flourishing, the bullshit. The
Yeah,
I'm going to write great stage direction too.
That's right. That's right. And they do write great. Breaking Bad, the stage directions are incredibly.
I'm always jealous when I see writers who write great stage direction. I'm like, I want to write great stage direction too. But that's the shit I cut away anyway. All right, keep going.
Sure,
sorry.
Sure.
Anyway, it was just
so you crank out
that
episode year one. and you
and I kept, you know, I stayed with it, and I went to the, you know, I went
and
to
you
the
go
every day
and have you gone back and watched that episode and been like, you know,
yeah,
relive
sure.
that where those no, ideas came from and what
no nothing those nothing it, there was a firewall
yeah,
there
yeah.
You know, fortunately on a cable show you have a few months between seasons to kind of recover. So after the season ended, I was kind of able to check in with myself a little bit more and kind of deal with – actually, only a little bit, to tell you the truth, because the Bliss thing happened.
Oh, okay.
And then I got a feature script that I'm doing as well.
But that's after the third season of Saul.
Yeah, but no, but actually all of that happened around the same time of this illness.
Okay.
And I just, in almost a manic way, I kept on saying yes because it was keeping me – sane,
sure,
in a way. It was you know, that was the tough year. The movie was difficult. This was existential.
Those are different. That's a, you know.
And, yeah.
Can I ask a question just about? Well, is there something else you want to say about this?
No, that was it.
Okay,
that was it. Except, you know, it was just the human side of things.
No, I mean, look, that's it's in all of the shit you realize that there is something always much bigger than you know, the problems and in the stage direction and all that stuff.
Well, let's talk about my per episode fee.
Well, no. but do you, is it something like in all writers' room or in this writer's room on Saul where like you're in the middle of, as a writer, when you're writing something, you're still going to keep having new ideas and like,
sure,
is there ever a time where you're like, holy shit, what if we actually did this, which doesn't jibe with the direction you've all agreed that you're going to go on? Can you sometimes come back in and say like, hey, guys, I'm writing my script. What if this happens?
Not on Saul. Mm-hmm. Not so much. A little bit. You know, little things. I wanted to add a scene where Mike is looking at his daughter and his granddaughter asleep in their room, sleeping together in the kids' room. And I was given their blessing on that. But with Saul, what Vince and Peter do is they, you know, they're in Burbank when it's shooting in Albuquerque most of the time. So their scripts are exactly what they intend. And that's why the screen directions, I think, are so kind of florid and specific, and as florid and specific are somewhat contradictory, but they were both of those things. And also because we went brick by brick, beat by beat,
yeah,
there was never any question when you went to go outline, when you went to go to script, there was never any question about what happens in this scene, how it plays out, how what people say, you know, various things. You're still a writer doing this thing, but you have it all laid out. And not only that, because you're the way that we do it, and as I'm sure this is the case, I think, with you guys, you know, there's a line, there's a thing. It's hard to sometimes point to say, oh yeah, that was Gordon, that was Jenny, that was mm-hmm. me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in the mix of it all, you just you're not thinking about, in the best case scenarios,
yeah,
in the best days in the room, you're not thinking about credit. You're not thinking about this was sure. my idea or what got rejected, what didn't get rejected. It's just so everybody has some authorship in your episode.
Yeah.
In as much as you have authorship in other people's episodes. So there's a kind of fealty to that, to the room, that you have to kind of respect.
But so keep going.
But it's a different way of working. A lot of rooms, every room is different. On Succession right now, Jesse, I think, is more about kind of like setting the parameters for the episode and then seeing what the writer comes up with and then kind of shaping that with the writer.
Yeah.
And it's a different thing.
Okay. So that's a great thing. So like, so on Saul versus Succession. So when you go to write your episode, what do you have laid out in front of you? Do you know that, okay, each act is going to end this way and the episode is going to end this way and then the rest I can outline myself? Or is it you have to have – there are going to be these scenes in act one, these scenes in act three, this scene for sure in act four, and the rest you can fill in blanks?
You know, it's not as regimented. In every episode is different. Bloodline was much more chaotic in the sense of like we had a beat sheet to work from. So it was literally one page with, you know, one lines of like this happens, this happens, this happens. And because of that, you didn't necessarily have to do it in that order because it was a document that's kind of thrown together out of what had been discussed. And it was a guideline but not a commandment. As I said, with Saul, it was you stuck to it.
Yeah,
you stuck to it, and that's what, or you stuck to it, or you went home.
Yeah,
it was great. I mean, it was boot camp. You know, it was how I learned to
from the best.
Absolutely. If I should be so lucky to run my own room, it will be not quite that.
Yeah.
But it'll be a mix of these yeah, different
the things that you learn from different people.
Saul was very intensive. It was 10 hours. As I said, you know, it was – I had these other things going on too, this feature that I had agreed to, thinking I'd be able to write it during Saul. And it was with this – it's currently with this director, Mark Forrester, who's a really great director, did Finding Neverland and Monster's Ball and shitload of things. And I wanted to do a good job on it, and I was not able to get to it. There were reasons partly because my last hiatus, they didn't quite get the contract shit worked out. So, you know, I was waiting, having gone through what I went through in the past with movies.
Yeah.
In the feature world, I was circumspect about
sure.
when, you know, I wasn't going to start until I got paid.
Sure.
And I think that's probably a pretty good working philosophy.
Yeah. After having been burned.
Yeah. Yeah. But so I had to, as it turned out, I had to try to write it during that season, and it was just impossible. And plus, there was all this stuff going on with my family, and I did finally finish that the first draft anyway of that feature. I got to write the second draft today. But it was when I was in London, because in London the show at Succession we go from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. That's our day.
Oh, okay.
We work through lunch. I don't feel like we're missing anything in doing that. And
it's a more reasonable work day, isn't it?
It's also, you know, it's the English know how to...
It's civilized.
It's civilized.
Yeah,
that's nice.
We had tea time and everything.
It must have been difficult to make the decision to leave Better Call Saul in the middle of everything.
Well, you know, part of it was that I was going to get sued if I didn't write this feature.
Yeah.
You know, part of it was also this David Cross show, Bliss, was really delightful to do with him. And it was just me and him, Mark Chappelle, and other writers, just the three of us. He's got a – Mark's got a great show on Netflix, Flaked, now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was and then you know, this HBO offer kind of came out of the blue. And it was a chance to do something from scratch. And I think Peter and Vince maybe sensed that I was getting a little itchy. And I didn't know it necessarily, but they sensed, you know. It's
because
like,
of the hierarchy or because of,
yeah, I mean, to some extent, you know, being a non-Breaking Bad guy, being somebody who clearly wants to do their own thing. And
yeah.
If not do their own thing, then you know, be a help shape something.
Yeah,
and here was a new show with this guy with the show Peep Show that I've been a fan of for years, and his other work I absolutely admired. And Frank Rich was an executive producer on the show, is an executive producer on the show, also on
Veep. Yeah,
and it was Adam McKay directed the pilot.
Oh, really? Wow.
And his company is also a production company on it. And it was just like, yeah. And I get to go to London, and it's just
nice to mix things up and be,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. And you know, Saul was going to be just fine without me.
Yeah, I'm still going to watch it.
Oh, please,
whether you're in or not,
I'm watching it too. I'm watching it too.
What if we're like, what if I email you? I'm like, Better Call Saul fourth season is by far the best.
Oh. Oh. It might well be too. It was tough on that score too. I mean, I knew shit was going to
start. Now things are heating up. Yeah,
things are absolutely going to be.
Ever, given your background, ever any desire to direct any of these episodes? Or
yeah, sure. I mean, but that's starting to creep back in.
Yeah,
as a desire.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's rarefied air to get an episode of, to direct an episode of Saul.
Absolutely,
or whatever.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah.
probably hard to get in yeah. line for that. But I mean,
but you know, as it was on Breaking Bad, Vince was very keen on having writers have that opportunity.
Yeah.
So Tom and Peter,
but you were never like, "Hey, come on, put Glatzer in there."
You know, it was maybe if no,
you could have. It was not. You didn't go to Jonathan Banks or like John. I really want to. Hey, you guys, I think you should let Johnny direct the Sabrecito.
Yeah, no. It was I don't think it was going to happen there, and I don't think it's going to happen on you know, it's not going to
really?
Happen this time on Succession. No, but I mean, you know, look, I don't have that resume. But
it seems like TV is that world where you can, I mean, you do have a resume, it's like you've been a director, but
sure.
I mean, and TV is a world where it's a creator's world, right? So the director
But I'm not the creator.
Is executing. Right? No, I'm saying like
the writer does. Writer is sort of king in television. The director is sort of king.
So I'm saying
films.
It's not like the thing is going to come crashing down if you directed.
Right.
It's you're being slotted into a situation where you're. You know,
that's true. That's true to some extent. Although I think.
What I'm saying is stop dicking around and direct a fucking episode of TV. That's
you're putting
I'm saying,
me into
man.
A bit of a corner here because anybody I work with on Succession listening to this.
If they're listening right now in hour two, listen to us.
You know, look, you know the joke of Mother Teresa. When she dies, she goes up to heaven and St. Peter's like, Teresa, we are so happy to have you here. God has given me license to basically – anything you want, you know, I mean, even if it's a little bit risque, you've earned it. And she's like, I don't know, I'm turning into a Yiddish
woman. No, you nailed it.
Well, yeah. I'd like to direct.
No.
Yeah. That's you know, everybody would love to do that. And
sure.
And if you've done it. I've done it. But because of that, I also know I'm not going to do it again until I'm ready to do it again. And I don't think I'm quite there yet.
Well, the nice thing about the TV industry is that certainly something we have come up against, I think, is that they really do take care of their own.
Yeah.
You know, and that's – I mean, every time we sell a show, we're like, oh, yeah, and the ones that they are going to shoot are the ones, yeah, he's the runner, showrunner of this thing. He's – oh, yeah, he ran that show. And it's right. like, okay. So, like, you know, you're certainly
– they want that experience.
Well, you realize also that you're building a resume – a legitimate resume that will
now he's got a huge and it's you know
I mean he's on the
huge
fucking,
resume
yeah
this guy over here
yeah.
All right, so you got
What's coming out? Bliss and Succession? Both of those or no?
Bliss and Succession, and hopefully this Greenpeace thing gets made. It's about the – I didn't mention the features about the early days of Greenpeace.
Oh, that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. Some, you know, egos and –
And it's set up – you've sold the script or you've –
Yeah, it's Bold Pictures is okay. The studio or the production company.
Yeah.
And
it's written. You have to do a second draft.
To do a second draft.
And are people attached to it?
No.
The director's attached?
The director's attached to it, yeah. Okay. We're going to go out to cast it probably after the second draft.
Okay.
I don't have a lot of time because I'm going to be going back to New York for Succession soon enough.
And are they? Is that where they shoot or are they?
Yeah, it's a New York show.
Okay.
Hasn't shot yet?
The pilot only.
Okay.
Yeah. So you're going to be out there for a while?
I'll be out there back and forth, yeah.
Okay. It's
easier than London.
I guess so, yeah.
Family.
And Bliss was in London, though.
Bliss was in London and in Bristol. Yeah. Shot there, but we wrote
and
it here.
And the season is – you did a shot of first season. It's done?
It's first season's done. It'll air in January.
And it's one of those British things where they do like three episodes in a season or what is it?
Yeah,
okay,
six.
Got it.
Mm. Yeah, not enough.
It's not enough.
But it is
– It's never enough.
Well, I say not enough partly because it's out of selfishness and it was fun and I want to do more. But it is a great shape.
I guess it is. I mean, it's a funny attitude because like – when those dudes, like that dude who wanted to get himself written off Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
What was that guy? I can't remember.
Andrew.
No, okay.
Matthew.
Matthew something. Whatever. He gets written, and I'm like, he's like, it's just too much work. And I'm like, and you look at him like, it's a 6-episode season.
Yeah.
And you're getting written off. Well, you want to get killed off the hottest show on TV.
Like, it's like the, like Cumberbatch, Benedict Cumberbatch. They had 3 episodes for Sherlock each season. No. You're like, you can't. Look, my voice is cracking. I'm so...
You can't do 3 episodes?
Yeah, that's the longest crack I've ever had, by the way.
That's a good one.
And I've had some long cracks, believe me.
Peter Brady days?
That's a good one.
No, but really, it's like 3 fucking episodes.
Yeah. They're like an hour and a half each day. I mean, they're like a feature.
Fair enough.
I guess.
You got me again, Glenn.
But once the cameras are rolling, it doesn't really matter how long it is. I mean, once the cameras are rocking and rolling.
Because to me, the ultimate thing would be to create an act in a television show that goes on for many seasons and wear all the hats and just have a great fucking time.
Uh-huh.
But I guess, you know, but once you're in it.
You're in it.
You know,
you're
look,
in it.
We just shot Super Troopers 2, and it's like, by like week 2, I was missing my fucking kids so badly.
Yeah.
That I was like, anything we can do to speed this up, I'll take it.
Yeah,
let's get out of here.
We communicated when I was in London, and that's kind of like the first and last sentence of everything I said.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, my family.
I know.
Yeah, it was just, it's rough.
I mean, we travel, we do stand up, and you're on the road, and whatever it is. And what you want is you want that job where you're just living and sleeping in your own bed, and every day you're going and doing it.
Yes.
You know, that's the thing, which is great. But it's the elusive thing in this day and age.
Well, the thing that I want to do, you know, the sort of
the dream project?
The dream project
for Glatzer?
That's you know,
the Connecticut
Peer Gynt, modern day.
It's something that shoots here too.
I mean, okay.
And it would shoot, you know, a lot of different places, but it's a Southern California story.
Okay. Let me know. I would love to be in it. So
you guys would be great in it.
Oh, thanks, man. All right. Yeah.
As a couple? As a bickering old gay couple? By the way, we tried to pitch that as a TV show.
We did pitch a TV show with us as a gay couple.
And our manager was like, no, never. And we're like, what? Why not? He's like, they'll never believe it. They'll never buy it. You're not allowed to. You're not gay. You're not allowed to. And we're like, oh, fuck you. Kevin was like, you ever see Liberace? That's Michael Douglas and Matt Damon. They're not gay. And
the world knows they're not gay.
Yeah. He's like, that's different.
They sold that shit.
Yeah. But we wanted to do like a show about a loveless gay married couple who are – it's like they're, you know.
Yeah.
That's not your Southern California thing though, is it? No.
It's not, that's but you know, we could work that.
Dream project? Okay.
You look great, Kev.
Thanks, bro.
You're still working on it.
You both fucking look great.
And thanks, man.
I got to say, why have none of you went bald?
I know.
None of you.
Yeah.
Not
what
yet.
What the fuck? It's like the Beatles. Except
we haven't.
You know, maybe Lennon might have, but you know, it's crazy.
I don't know. I don't know why.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, this is what our last TV pitch we went around town with. It was called Bald Guys.
Really?
And it's about a group of friends who bond because of their premature baldness and gets them into a bunch of situations.
Many relationships that way. Yeah.
And so, you know, we pitched around and it didn't sell to anyone.
By the way, to bring it full circle, it was because of my experience as playing Finkelstein in Beer Fest.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
You look very convincing in that.
Well, you know, I'll tell you this, though. Like, being in Albuquerque with a receding hairline and a big afro, people wanted to kick my ass all the time.
Now you know what it is to be a Jew in this world.
Well, dude, there were guys who would come up to me with a fist cock and say, I should kick your ass.
Really?
Yeah. And that was sort of the genesis.
That's where we started writing this TV show.
Yeah. 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 Now, it's the three male writers on Succession, me, Tony, and Jesse, we're all cue balls.
Oh, really?
And there's a writer assistant
pitched them.
There.
I know.
Yeah. There's a writer assistant there. He's like 30, and he's clearly on the way.
Yeah. That was one of our characters, too.
Yeah.
The guy who's on the way.
And he literally would take me aside and be like, can you give me any advice?
Did he really?
Yeah. How'd you deal with him? Did you do the Rogaine thing? Yeah. Did you just, you know,
let it go?
Accept it.
That's what our show was.
Yeah.
And it's funny because we'd sometimes pitch.
You'd pitch a bald executive. And then you'd have to be
you know the thing it's tough. Which is great when you're pitching?
I was known as the guy with the hair at Colgate.
Oh, you did have the hair.
I had hair.
You had kinky, curly hair.
You did have hair. Yeah. Okay.
Do you know what is one thing that we didn't do?
Holy fuck, we didn't chew.
We never chewed.
That's
what were we supposed to chew?
Yeah.
Well, this is great. This will.
We can do it on the way out.
Exercise your acting chops. Okay.
Okay.
He hasn't acted since Peer Gynt. He hasn't acted.
He's about to act right now. We like to chew things.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's called chewing it. So.
Yeah.
We're gonna chew together, and then you're gonna chew solo. And then you're going to tell us what you were eating. And we'll tell you what we were eating, too.
Oh, God. What am I going to eat?
Wow.
I don't even know what I'm going to eat. Go.
Okay.
He's a slower chewer. He's a slow, deliberate chewer. Like Better Call Saul.
We don't know what he's having. Yeah. He's the Better Call Saul.
He's the Better Call Saul.
Chewing.
Slow, deliberate. Bloodline. Slow and deliberate. What do you got? Okay. What are you chewing?
Well, it was an acting thing because I was my sister.
Okay.
He was my sister.
Another person.
This is a first. This is a first.
Really?
We've never had someone do this.
Chewing at somebody else.
Chewing a banana in my ear.
Okay.
Which she used to do all the fucking time to get me to move from her favorite seat to watch the TV.
I love that.
And it worked every time because it was. Just try it.
You know what that means, though. You're probably one of those guys, and we have people who write to us, and you hate the sound of chewing then. Like, you probably have a psychological problem with the sound of chewing.
No, it depends on who's chewing.
Okay.
If I don't like the person and then they're chewing.
Then I don't like the chew.
It's tough. I worked with somebody recently. They chewed with their mouth open.
Oh. I work with those guys all the time.
But if Jonathan Banks could chew whatever he wants.
Jonathan Banks could chew my banana.
Yeah.
I don't care.
He's so fucking radical.
He could do anything. Yeah, I mean, they were, any of those guys. But my son chewing, and he instantly was a very polite chewer, mouth closed, and I love listening to him chew.
It's the best.
Right. I love listening to him gulp.
I do. I like watching my kids eat.
Yeah.
Is it gross?
I like watching my kids eat.
It's my favorite thing in the world.
Yeah, I love watching my kids eat.
I tell my five-year-old, I'm like, mouth closed. He's been pretty civilized for a while now. But like when I have to remind him of it, he does an exaggerated mouth closed chew, and I love that too. I love that too.
All right, what were you chewing?
Lobster tail.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Okay.
I had some lobster tail, and
you did. I bet you did. You.
Yeah. What were you eating?
Hot dog.
I was gonna go with hot dog.
I bet you were, you little so and so.
I was gonna go with hot dog, and then it would have been a threesome.
Yeah. Wow, that would have been good.
Hot dog is the best.
Hot dog's pretty good.
Is there anything better than a hot dog?
Well, so hot dogs are good in concept, but you know, afterwards.
They're good in moderation. Like my son actually said to me yesterday, he said, "Dad, no more hot dogs for a while. I've been eating too many hot dogs lately."
Okay. That's something I've never said in my entire life.
Fine, no problem.
Do you do Franks and beans as well?
No, my kids won't eat beans.
Okay,
I eat beans and then they get afraid. But that's okay.
Yeah, well, that's a whole.
Here comes the napalm, kids.
That's right.
That's a whole other podcast.
Oh, shit. All right.
Let's
wrap it up.
We chewed. All right, Jonathan Glatzer.
We had a lot of paths to go.
We had a lot to get through. We had a lot to get through.
I was 17 when we all met.
I know. You know. It was so long ago.
That's 30 years ago.
I know.
What are we supposed to do? 2 hours.
I know. I haven't seen you since then. So
I know.
Yeah,
that's what you got to talk about.
It was a total privilege and thrill.
Thank you.
And
it was fun.
I was just looking forward to this.
Oh, good.
So much.
Good.
This was really great.
No, thanks for coming.
It's a nice excuse to shoot the shit, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the thing we always talk about. The best part about doing the podcast is catching up with people that you haven't seen in a while.
Yeah, yeah.
It's true. All right, let's wrap it up then. Shut up, Lemmy. Let's wrap it up. All right, thanks, everybody. Let's chew on the way out, everybody. Jonathan, join us.
We did chew. I'm chewing something else.
Susan and her banana.
I'm going key lime pie.
Thanks, Chew Crew. Talk to you next week.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.